Can we begin now? Albemani's suggested, because I'm the oldest around here, that I should have the privilege of introducing our speakers this afternoon. And Martin Thomas is the first. He's only got half an hour, so I'm not going to take any more time. Martin.
Okay. Thank you, Professor Simmons. That was a very brief introduction indeed. Thank you all for being here. Thanks very much for the invitation to have some time to talk to you about something which may be of interest to some of you and I think should be of interest to us all. I won't waste a lot of time on the content except to say that I'll pick up on one or two of the themes that have already been raised today and hopefully go through a worked example as I get towards the end of the presentation. But the first question is, does management accounting have an impact upon governance, and if so, how and why? And if I look at the decision-making information that's required for governance institutions of any sort, I can think of the financial accounting drivers that tend to be driven by markets and therefore looking for comparability, which ends up with standardisation as a requirement. And we've already heard that the available information is what shapes the decisions that governors of any institution can take. If you look at the management accounting drivers, then I think we've got a completely different set of drivers. The target that we're setting is we're targeting market for the leaders of organisations. Now, whether you call those governors or managers, in a sense, is not material to the discussion, I argue, because what they're looking for is meaning, and this meaning requires contextualisation. So the outcome of the management accounting drivers, I argue, will have a contextualised information, whereas if the financial accounting drivers are left to shape that alone, you'll tend to end up with standardised information, which delivers, I believe, compliance but rigidity, whereas management information as a driver is going to deliver relevance and adaptability. Pause for lots of hands to go up and arguments. No, I'm not taking questions at the moment. That'll be for the later session. But I do argue that relevance and adaptability are critical to governance and management in shaping the decisions that can be taken. This is a summary of some work that was published a few years ago in Business Planning for Turbulent Times. A bit of research I did for my master's. And the... Oops, why are we going backwards? Is this on the timer or something? This tries to draw a line that Emery and Trist depicted in 1965, in which they saw a placid context of business turning into turbulent fields, which they described as type 4. At that stage, you can still deal with it, and they talked about how to deal with turbulence in a constructive and cohesive way. Once you get into these other levels of disturbance that McCannon, Selsky and Babaroglu published in the 80s, you're already talking about a field that's divided when people are fighting for their own neck of the woods, their own pool of resources, and not to a common good. So it's quite important that organisations understand where they stand in this spectrum of things. And coming out of the Emery and Trist work... I'll come on to that in a moment. The unit of analysis that we're talking about, we're considering, is the organisation and its environment. Okay, so earlier on we were talking about whether control is a factor here. Well, if you take the Bill Smith approach to power structures, the only bit that an organisation can control as such is the intra-organisation performance. The transactional environment, beyond that, you can influence, and the contextual environment, that's to say the institutions and entities with whom you don't interact in a transactional sense, but influence the transactional environment, that contextual environment you can understand, you can appreciate, but you can't directly influence except via the transactional environment, and you certainly can't control. So the linearity that you get that we were accustomed to, that allowed people to think that they could control things very directly, goes out of the window when you start talking about complex systems and how you exercise soft control as well as soft influence, soft power, and not only hard power of decision making and control. This is a slide which is far too fussy, I know, but it's the first part of those four types of that Emery and Trist talked about, and I really just show it so that I can focus on the one bit that they identified that determines successful strategy in turbulent fields. Remember, in this level three, this is where we've all been used to working. This is the sort of oligopolistic market, and the knowledge that you need is you need to know when not to fight to the death. There's a sort of dynamic stability that obtains in those markets by entities coming to terms between competitors. I don't mean necessarily cartel type coming to terms between competitors, but understanding when not to fight to the death. When you get into turbulent fields, the characteristic is that it's not just the interaction between the organisations that characterises the field, but the ground is in motion. The rules of the game are changing. The certainties that one thought one could rely upon in type three context are no longer valid. So, and there's an interdependency between economic and other social factors, and that comes back to the Cadbury comments that we were hearing earlier, when Cadbury said that he believed in his drafting that governance should include aligning individuals, corporations and society in general. So this is what they're saying in these, that the successful strategies of organisations depend upon the institutionalisation, as they call it. Embodying society's values becomes a strategic objective. And to create an ethical code that enables simplified action in a complex situation requires values, commonly held values, to be the drivers of, and that overrides both strategy and tactics, they argue. Now, individual organisations in that situation cannot adapt alone. They need to develop relationships between dissimilar organisations, and we heard that from Michael Power as well, looking at the way that you could get scenario thinking and inter-firm collaboration, BA and EasyJet he mentioned, to try and foment the development of common values and to share them. Okay, so if you go past that, you get into these fields, and I won't go into this in detail. This is when partitioning occurs and the vortices that are left outside the partitions, outside the enclaves, are left without the resources and skills needed to adapt to the environment. And in that fifth situation, I think you can think of maybe Syria at the moment as a practical example of the fifth situation. You've got monothematic dogmatism, stalemate and polarisation. So those, you get into a triple bind and it looks as though nothing's changing, but of course the forces that drove for change are there and still moving beneath the surface, and you need collective and external strategy to deal with those. So that's I believe where context starts, and where an appreciation of context helps governance and management to appreciate where they are and what sort of strategies they should be adopting. When it comes to organisational performance, there's quite a lot that's been going on in recent years. Porter, that was one of the founders of competitive shareholder value creation, has published in 2011 with Kramer a paper in which he takes a not 180-degree turn, but maybe a 90-degree turn, and says that shared values, shared between your organisation and the stakeholders that your organisation has, sharing, creating shared value should be the main objective. World Business Council for Sustainable Development, Mr. Bakker has recently been pronouncing at the A4S meeting in December that accountants are going to change the world. And he's really saying that sustainability requires the sort of approach that capitalism has adopted for many years, but looking not just at monetary capital, but at social and environmental capital as well. So the International Integrated Reporting Council is proposing integrated reporting, people, planet and profits. UK is consulting on that, and non-profit organisations have been looking for some sustainability criteria as well. In South Africa, King 3 already requires accounting for sustainability of quoted companies since 2011. And for me, and I think for the discipline, McElroy and Van Engelen's book of 2012 on context-based metrics set a gold standard for establishing norms based on local context that represent sustainable performance for the organisation in question. I'll build on that later. I don't need to go on to the others, but let's just save some time. Research by Oxford Economics for the CGMA launch in January 2012 said that on a 4-to-1 basis, managers, this is a European and North American survey, I believe, amongst quoted companies. Investor demands are inconsistent with growing a sustainable business, 4-to-1 thought. And 6-to-1 thought that investor focus on short-term reward made it difficult to plan for the long term. So there's some of the things that we've been doing in the financial and management accounting fields that are not consistent with what top managers believe they need to be doing. So lots are trying to find a way to work towards sustainable success. So what is sustainable development and what does thriving mean?
I've got a clock there. Crikey, time's going on.
Okay, the Brundtland definition, and this requires new values to be practiced in most organisations, is the point I'm making. And thriving requires and goes beyond sustainability. It implies capital creation. And traditionally that would have been financial capital creation. I think in a sustainable world, it can be capital creation of any of those three capitals, so long as you're meeting all of the sustainability criteria. Triple bottom line is not new. It goes back 300 years. But John Elkington's the most recent publisher of that. Don't need to explain this to you people, because this is Hicksian capital maintenance, that opening capital, closing capital minus opening capital gives you the income that you've generated during the year. Triple bottom line simply extends that from economic capital to social capital and to natural capital. The process that McElroy and Van Engelen published 2011-2012 defined the carrying capacity as the vital capitals of those that natural, social and economic assets that provide the capacity for the development which meets the Brundtland definition. And it seems to me that the governance question for all organisations is, does our organisation believe we need not maintain all capitals? We heard this morning that the discussion of unpopular topics is a very difficult thing in lots of governance forum, and I think this is a key question. Context, each organisation needs to determine its own vital capitals in its own specific context. So that's the organisation nested in the economy, and it will look at its economic stakeholders that will help determine their context. It will look beyond that into society at large and the stakeholders there that can give them an idea of the vital capitals of a social nature, and indeed it will look into the environment as well. And this is the logic that Van Engelen and McElroy have developed for determining context. Identify the stocks and flows that an organisation is or should be having impact upon in ways that can affect stakeholder well-being. The second step is to determine the responsible populations for ensuring the quality and sufficiency of the related stocks and flows. And then you allocate proportionate shares of those stocks and flows or burdens of those shares to produce them and or maintain them to the organisation. So from that total population, what is a proportion that is appropriate to the organisation in question? And from that you move on to step four, which is to set the standards of performance for organisational sustainability. Now, they've given lots of examples of a social and an environmental nature. My work with them has been to extend that into economic capital maintenance. Now, this next sentence is the one that requires the challenge, if any of you don't believe it to be true. Without standards of performance for organisational sustainability, it is impossible to determine whether or not the organisation is performing in a sustainable way. In other words, CSR, which Professor Suzuki at Oxford tells me in Japan, even the leading companies in CSR reporting are withdrawing from, are declining in. CSR doesn't give any answers. It produces interesting information about eco-efficiency or socio-economic efficiency or economic efficiency maybe, but it doesn't say what's enough. It never asks the question of what is required to be sustainable. So we don't know of any other process or system or set of criteria that would determine whether an organisation is performing sustainably or not. I argued that I can apply exactly his criteria to financial and economic capitals, and this is a small worked example that I'll go through briefly. So we say, who are the key stakeholders? Shareholders, long-term lenders, and taxation authorities, let's say. What are the capital stocks and flows? So stocks in italics, flows in bold, equity in real terms, dividend flows, loan capital, loan repayment capacity, interest payments due, etc., tax payments as due. I'll go through each of those in turn, starting with the long-term lenders. If the interest payment due is the responsibility of the board of directors, the contractual interest due is what's due to be paid. The loan repayment capacity, that contractual interest due is, of course, taken into financial accounts in any case. There's nothing new in that. Loan repayment capacity is not necessarily something which all organisations take account of explicitly. When you talk to the stakeholders about it, you might find that either legally or quite often not legally, they've got a requirement that free cash flow should cover the loan repayments due. In that way, you can maintain your loan repayment capacity. So that would be a new requirement by engaging with stakeholders of a financial nature. So the smiley face says that's already accounted for, no additional duties, and the star says that's a new requirement. So that's long-term lenders, and we've covered that. Tax authorities, tax payments as due is what they want. If we pay all tax payable as due, the financial accounts show that there are no additional duties owed to this stakeholder. This, of course, begs the question of what happens when multinationals are organising their affairs in such a way as to minimise their corporation tax payable in a particular country, which the press in the UK has been very hot on just lately. Well, that may be an issue for customers, as Starbucks found out, but it's not an issue that the tax authorities will raise, because they'll generally simply recognise that the legal duties are all that are due to be paid to them. By the way, you can use this process to look at the total amount of taxes due and the total amount of social services that are absorbed and do some balancing between them if you wish to see whether there really is an imbalance. The process lends itself to that, but it's not a requirement. It's not a requirement from these financial stakeholders in any case. So when we get to equity shareholders, and this is where the tough bit comes, you may say that they've got a dividend flow requirement. Okay, this is not always something which is taken account of explicitly in the dividend, in the internal management accounting, but it may be that a cash dividend of 25 cents per share ensures the investor well-being on that front, and there's a new criterion that we establish. Talking to the equity stakeholders, or shareholders as they're usually called, they want their capital stock maintained, and the expectation of a risk-adjusted real annual return on the capital invested may be sufficient to do that. If the real long-term interest rates are 2% per annum and risk adjustment adds another 3%, the cost of equity totals 5% per annum, let's say, and there are lots of ways that you can establish this. You will all have multiple ways of doing this better than I've outlined in this example, but the principle holds. Since this represents the opportunity cost of the shareholder's investment in the company, it represents an economic charge which is not taken to the P&L account, but which can be used in determining the sufficiency of the return on the equity investment in the business, and can also be cascaded through your divisional accounting requirements as a cost of capital to subdivisions of the company or entity or whatever sort new. So that's where we've got a couple of new requirements and a couple of three new requirements and three old ones. So we've applied this economic context-based principle in identical ways to the way that McElroy and Van Engeland use it for non-financial capitals, which means that we've got some comparable data to put on the table for management and for governance institutions to talk about how they redress imbalances. I won't go into that in more detail, simply to say that this balance of what's sustainable and what's unsustainable is something that this approach allows you to do. I don't know any institution that does this at the moment, and so I believe it's a new tool. And, of course, how you fill the metric, this process allows governance individuals to sit down and take decisions about what they're going to do to redress the balance or not. Because a lot of those desires that come in from the stakeholder community are going to be incompatible one with another. That's not a surprise. But for a governance forum to be able to sit down and address those issues is, I believe, something new. A thriving organisation, as we say, needs to meet all those sustainability criteria and choose to create new capital in one or more of the capitals involved. New value in one of the capitals involved. If this were for LSE, you would expect that it would want to be maximising its social value in the field of educational benefit or maybe knowledge creation. That's an important aspect of a thriving organisation that goes beyond simple, just sustainability. There's a double loop implementation and review cycle that's attached to this process. Nothing new in that. While you're in the operational cycle, you just keep going around, measuring, planning, doing, measuring, planning, doing, and every now and again you have to go back to identifying the key stakeholders, setting standards of performance, and then going back into the operating cycle. So in this way, and this is a slide from Mark McElroy, this shows how in a practical way we get stakeholders to feed the turbulent context into the performance metrics of the organisation. We start down here, the company and its relationships with its stakeholders, employees, suppliers, customers, communities, and of course shareholders. This gives rise to a set of duties and obligations to have and or manage the impacts on resources important to stakeholder well-being. If those duties are met, then that helps ensure stakeholder well-being is met, and it protects shareholder value. So there's the business payoff for it in old world terms. And if it doesn't, then it puts stakeholder well-being and shareholder value at risk. There's the risk analysis component of this that Michael was talking about earlier. And so we've developed a process that sets some norms, measures performance against those norms, and enables the outside world to feed into those norms in a way which can enable us to determine whether our performance as an organisation is sustainable or not. And that's basically it.
I said to Martin that we'd give him another 5 minutes because we started a bit late. Does anybody have any urgent question of Martin? Or we leave it to the discussion? Yes.
Karen Reed, the Aldenham Foundation. I wasn't quite sure in your talk whether, because you spoke against measuring performance against norms, whether you were talking about performance regarding past information, because that's what you normally base performance on, past information.
Yes.
Or whether these concepts that you've got here need you to actually integrate future plans and future budgets, because otherwise I can't see how you're going to know that you're going to be covering your loan over the long term, etc., if you don't incorporate those fully.
Absolutely. Well, the present is, of course, an infinitely small point in time, because we're always dealing with the facts of the past and the projections for the future.
Correct.
So
yeah.
I don't draw the line between governance and management that we saw this morning, which is that governance is only about the past. In fact, theoretically, how can it be if you're not going to take any account of action in the future? Okay, so this is essentially a management accounting approach, and management accounting always looks to the future as well as the past, I would suggest.
Martin, thank you very much.
Thank you
indeed,
very much.
We'll pick this up with the discussion later on. So, Alfred, where is he? Alfred Wagenhofer, all the way from Austria. We will have time for questions for you after, right. Alfred. Off you go.
All right. Thanks very much for the short introduction. The issue I'm going to talk about will be a little bit different, although you've heard several presentations today which all tie into the main field. I think what I'm going to talk is taking sort of a different angle on the team, and I guess I understood Michael and Al when they invited me to want to provide sort of a broader picture of approaches to the topic of what we're talking today, and this broader topic is more like in the methodology we are using. It's not just the accent, actually. All right. What can you expect from what we're going to talk about? When you look at management accounting information, that's providing information. Preparing information, providing information, and somebody else usually makes decisions on those. And obviously, it plays a major role in corporate governance, and it contributes to transparency within the corporate company and to the outsiders. And there's a big body of research talking sort of about relationships between accounting and corporate governance. Most of that research is basically empirical, and I'm going to focus on one of the topics to some sort of more extent. And the basic idea here essentially is demand for management accounting information. How would that look like if board of directors are making best use of that information? So the structure of the talk will be sort of give you a little bit overview of corporate governance board characteristics. We have heard already about those in previous talks. And then I'm going to pick on a specific issue, which is board monitoring and accounting conservatism, because financial accounting particularly has a kind of bias regarding to conservative accounting. And this usually sort of ties up pretty well with corporate governance, because most people would assume that managers are sort of a little bit optimistic. So boards in the monitoring role should have sort of a prudent or conservative bias. And so the question here I'd sort of like to talk about a little bit more is how that would work out. And then I'm going to try some speculation on interesting research issues, but that will be something that we can continue in the following discussion. And I particularly sort of take an information economics perspective here, and this is sort of the different methodology relative to the previous talks, which is essentially, what do I mean with that? It's like basically economics-based modeling and strategic interaction between different players, how information is being interpreted, how it's being used, how to make strategic advantage of that information. All right, so to sort of start with, there's a lot of functioning of board of directors, and if you could really go back to sort of the roots of corporate governance, most of them would start with agency problems in firms, right? So you give into the hands of managers money, so the managers are not the owners of the firm, and so this generates a lot of agency problems, and there's a lot of different mechanisms to try to optimize that situation. And so the boards, basically, they have a number of roles, and I just mentioned a few of those. You have heard about those in previous talks. So monitoring and advising, which is per se kind of interesting, because if you advise, you make management perhaps pick up your decision, then you try to monitor that one. So there's some inherent conflict of interest to some extent, but also approving strategic decisions, which means you control certain behavior of management. And one major function is also hiring and replacing senior management and also writing executive compensation contracts in a sense. So what would be good performance measures? How would you sort of structure the compensation? So management accounting information is sort of a major input to these board decisions and also the evaluation of boards. And also, much of the literature sort of talks about board structure in this regard. The good thing about, the interesting thing about boards is like this is sort of a group decision process. You can sort of shape the behavior of boards by putting in sort of different peoples with different backgrounds and experience or expertise. Also independence, we were talking about that, but also diversity, which is sort of en vogue these days. And the question also is about sort of what will be inherent incentives to boards. So I guess what I'm going to sort of focus on in, to some extent is that many people would think certain characteristics or mechanisms are seen on their own or discussed on their own, but essentially all those things basically serve the same basic objective, reducing agency problems or addressing agency problems, and they're all endogenous. So composition of boards, the responsibilities taken up by those, the compensation of boards, and also the information that they receive or should demand are all decision variables within the firm. So, I mean, there are obviously some legal and institutional constraints and restrictions with governance codes, but also legal requirements. But essentially, one tries to sort of shape those things best relative to the others. And just to give you sort of a glimpse of what endogeneity means, in many cases, at least this is my interpretation, endogeneity is ignored in many empirical studies. And so once you do empirical studies, like one example here, sort of there's some literature trying to figure out how board size is related to profitability or performance of companies, right? And most of these studies find there's a significant effect that smaller boards are associated with better performing companies, right? So there's a negative interaction between those two. So if you find that, and this is sort of empirical literature that looks about sort of broad samples, statistical significance, and all these kind of things. So what would you conclude out of those? I mean, the easy way is, oh, reduce board size, and then we get more profitable, right? And obviously it's not that simple as you can imagine. I mean, you can do it with other possibilities as well. So basically we see associations and the conclusions drawn from those associations, but it's not clear what's causal to what, right? And so it's not that simple. And so endogeneity is sort of a major issue. And that the benefit of doing economic models is like to really sort of get a hold on those endogeneity kind of issues. And there's a lot of stuff on executive compensation, which I don't want to talk here about, but I'd like to talk about characteristics of accounting information in this regard. So what does that sort of mean here? There are, starting with some sort of one of those famed, well-known surveys in JE 2010 by Armstrong, Guy, and Weber. They sort of look at mostly empirical literature, more information, more detailed information, you know, a higher quality or more accuracy of information, more timely information, more frequent information, mostly neutral information. These kind of things are sort of looked at because there's some kind of proxies that you can see from these large archival data sets. And then what the literature does is look at the accounting characteristics and trying to associate those with strong or weak governance. And there's also sort of a proxy kind of problem, right? I mean, how do you measure strong or weak governance? But the fun thing is here that it looks like, I mean, you always want to have more detailed information. You want higher quality information. You want more timely information, more frequent information. You always want neutral information. So where's the trade-offs here, right? So it looks like that the answers to those problems or questions are pretty obvious, but actually they aren't. And I give you some kind of examples here. Aggregation of information. Why wouldn't you give sort of more detailed information? There is some economic argument why you want to sort of aggregate information, and accounting is about aggregation in particular. So it can serve as a commitment device not to be too aggressive on information. Because you might have an issue of motivating managers to look at short-term versus long-term kind of issues. And so if you act too aggressively on the short-term results and sort of changing the compensation structure in the next period based on that information, that would motivate managers to do things very differently in the first period, and it could be really a bad thing. Right, so aggregating could help sort of being a commitment device in those things and could benefit firms. The next thing is interim reporting. I mean, there's been a big discussion in the European Union about quarterly reporting versus semi-annual or annual reporting. And the logic behind that argument here is short-termism comes with short-term reporting. And this seems like obvious, but it's not that obvious, because as long as you can commit how to use that information, you wouldn't care, right? But obviously that additional information, if that's being sort of placed on the market, then you would use it. And if you overuse it again, you create short-termism, which is something which might sort of destroy value in companies. So basically the characteristics of accounting information are important, and they should always be looked at in complement to other sources of information that boards have. When I start talking about conservatism next, one important thing to make a link of is that the empirical literature on governance usually does not distinguish between internal management reports and published financial reports. So most of the archival empirical studies are about external financial reporting and looking at, is that conservative or higher quality or whatever, and then links that to boards. So basically, boards obviously can obtain a lot of information, but essentially the argument here would, I would think, is financial reports are still the most important one that they get. It's not only that this sort of is the base for all the sort of different kind of information that one would get, but also shareholders evaluate the board based on financial information. The board evaluates the management based on performance measures that are tied to contracts. And obviously there's a lot of benefits of using sort of a single accounting system. So it's better understandable, less confusing if you have two or three different profit figures. So yeah, I mean, can you pick and choose which one is sort of the best one or not, right? So it's easier to communicate, it's less costly. And of course, in IFRS, for example, we do have a management approach, for example, in segment reporting, where internal figures are basically communicated to the external market. So essentially, everybody's kind of looking for sort of very aggregate measures, even if you report different dimensions. Eventually, it would need sort of a trade-off between one going up and one going down. So essentially, that part of information is sort of very, very important, I guess. And then once you're sort of going back to financial reporting as the base for further sort of looking at management reports, then we obviously observe that there's a lot of different rules that are pretty weird to some extent, at the first sight at least. So asymmetric recognition of assets and liabilities, for example. R&D is usually not recognized. I mean, obviously you do different measures then, but obviously it's not part of earnings to some extent. Restructuring is sort of directly expensed usually, rather than being used as an investment and accounting for as investment. We do have conservatism, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that, lower of cost of market or impairment, or we don't recognize unrealized gains usually, but we do recognize unrealized losses, so that generates sort of some asymmetry. And the question here is, do we like that or don't we like that for management reporting issues? But also presentation, I mean, what's non-recurring gains and losses and these kind of things, right? So what does management accounting do with that? I mean, there's several possible ways to deal with these kind of issues. One would be to try to internally use discretion as much as you can in financial reports to adjust those numbers, also to be able or be useful for internal purposes. Many companies would do adjustments to financial performance measures, and performer earnings was sort of a big thing in over the last 10 or 20 years. Now we see it in management in the management approach in segment reporting, where we have this kind of reconciliation items, and people sort of look at segments on a very different way, in a very different way to what they would look at sort of the financial reports under IFRS, for example. So the other way would be to use additional measures like non-financial measures, and we just heard about that. I mean, you have triple bottom lines and all these kind of things. But still, you need to figure out what's the bottom line after all, because you want to make certain decisions based on those. And if you have, so, say, three measures, you need to come up with a sort of way to compare those. If one goes up, the other goes down, what's the substitution rate of those things, right? So, and we still have difficulty in understanding then and communicating those things. So, as I said, I'd like to briefly focus on conservative accounting, and this is sort of prevalent in financial reporting, and there's some empirical literature that looks at reports. And there's a measure on conservatism. There are different ways to get a hold on conservatism. And usually what that literature finds is that stronger boards, whatever stronger means, and this needs to be determined or defined in the respective study, that they would report more conservatively. So this is sort of a strong association. And it's less clear why that would be the case. All right. So there's some possible arguments, and one argument would be, it mitigates agency costs. That's obviously good, right? Because everything tries to reduce agency costs, so it must be helpful in that. And how would they do it? It reduces the tendency of managers to invest in long-term negative NPV projects if they are short-term positive, right? Because if you look at short term, then you have a benefit relative to the other one, which is more useful in the long run, but not in the sort of 1 or 2 years time horizon that people look at. Or it will motivate managers to abandon poorly performing projects early, because you have to recognize any expected losses up front, but not the gains, so you shift those things, or it uses early violation of debt covenants, right? So these are seen as sort of reducing or mitigating agency costs. The other example would be management has usually an incentive to hide bad performance, but at least sort of usually tell good performance, right? So you just have that sort of bias, and what early recognition of bad news would mean, it imposes greater cost on the upward bias and would be helpful and work with this kind of incentive of management in the other direction. Or it would reduce litigation reputation risk. And that would be because directors usually have a sort of asymmetric loss function. If everything goes well, I mean, sort of that main directors or auditors don't have sort of a major benefit. It's like a put option type of thing, right? But if things go really bad, then you have sort of trouble. And so trying to avoid that to some extent. So the problem, well, there's several problems actually, or caveats to these arguments. One would be, it could be that the proxies to measure these things are really bad, and you pick up something else. So we don't actually really know what either the accounting conservatism is. It's not clear what that really means, but also the governance variables, right? And the other, which is more important, I guess, here, is that these pretty plausible arguments are less compelling if you really think through. And given the one example again, sort of that management has a tendency to publish good news but trying to hide bad news. So essentially, conservatism would sort of trigger bad news being published. But that's not conservative after all, because at the end, if that really works, you got good news before, and now you've got the bad news as well. So it's at least neutral then. So why would you come up with conservative as a result, right? So that doesn't work. That's the kind of issues, I guess, that I might look at. Or, I mean, the earlier violation of debt covenants I was talking about briefly. So accounting conservatism, the argument is, lets you break or get to the threshold of covenants pretty quickly, right? But why wouldn't you just change the threshold, right? Okay, so there are different arguments to come up with these things. So these arguments are not that sort of compelling, and the interesting thing here is to look at sort of things from an economic perspective, and that's what I try to do, sort of giving you a flavor of an economics-based argument of a rigorous development of how these things would one could explain those observations, right? So the neutral question I'd like to talk about a little bit now is if the board is free to choose the degree of bias, do you want to have neutral information or do you want to have biased information? Would you want to have neutral or biased information if you are the board and make decisions? And I base that on the work I've done with Yanming Gao, which is a working paper right now. The idea with these models is like to abstract from a lot of real sort of complexities and really focus on a few things and trying to figure out what drives the behavior here. So I just look at monitoring and hiring replacement of senior management. Right? So these are the kind of tasks by the board. There are extensions one can do later on. We can talk about these subsequently. To make sort of the argument strict, suppose there are two types of managers. Type A is sort of a good fit to the firm's strategy, and type B is a bad fit. And neither manager nor the firm know ex-ante whether they fit or not, right? Because there are information asymmetries on both sides. Right, so there's a market, and the board sort of picks one manager up front, and then receives accounting information, and then makes decision whether to replace the manager or keep the manager in the future. Right, so basically, the type of the person is not so good or bad or talented, untalented people. It's more like fitting to a certain environment in firm. Right, so this is the more neutral and firm specific kind of issue. Right, What is going on here? So the board of directors has the task to hire a manager, then, as I said, observes the accounting information, period performance, and then decides to monitor or not. So the board can monitor or put more effort into monitoring or less effort into monitoring, and then makes a decision on the retention or replacement of the manager. And that information and that decision is based on the accounting information and the monitoring information, right? So we got two types of information in here, and then the question arises: what kind of accounting information is most helpful in this situation, right? And to have one friction in the model is like replacing a manager is costly, which is pretty obvious, I guess. And this sort of creates a transaction cost, which people want to avoid as much as possible. So the question is, how does the board monitor? And I use sort of two representations of monitoring efficiency. One would be effectiveness, which is, does the board figure out the type with high probability or with low probability, and the other one is the cost of monitoring. So higher cost makes it less efficient to monitor, right? So these are the kind of things. One can obviously affect efficiency with different board compositions. So if you get more advising kind of people on the board, you have maybe less monitoring effectiveness. If you have more like auditor people or controllers on board, right, that would be more monitoring, but maybe less advising kind of structures here, right? So this is kind of another decision variable one can look at. So this is the only sort of, and I apologize for that, the only structure we've used is some symbols. No more symbols, right? Okay. To just give you sort of the main feature of the argument, right? Or look at the production process, and to make it really simple, it's like a binary process. There are the two types, okay? Type A and type B managers, and there's some probability that on the market I hire an A or a B type, all right? So there's some uncertainty on up front. And then I look at the incremental benefit of having a good-fitting manager. So the good-fitting manager generates sort of a surplus, which is called X here, which the bad-fit type doesn't do. And the good type, or the A type in this regard, would be only with probability P, sort of gives you an additional benefit, but with one minus P also doesn't produce any more, right? So essentially we end up with two outcomes, either normal kind of thing or sort of extra profit, which would be the upper part, right? And the question then is the accounting system. The accounting system, since the outcome comes up later or is a multi-dimensional kind of thing, long-term effects and all this kind of thing, so you need a short-term performance measure. So the measure is like the earnings here, and we can have high or low earnings. And what we usually have with any information system, it's almost never perfect. So there are always some kind of errors. And try to sort of structure the errors in a way that with high chance, if the outcome is not sort of the good one, you get low earnings or you can get high earnings. And then there are two types of errors, right? The two types of errors are such that if the outcome is really good or will be good, actually, it still can be show up as low earnings here, right? On the other hand, the type 2 error means if sort of there's no sort of additional benefit, it could be that the accounting system still reports high earnings for some reason, right? And the question here then is how to design an accounting system with regard to the different kinds of errors. So essentially, if you assume that there's some kind of noise in the system, you never get the true earnings up front because it's long-term effects and all this kind of thing. So suppose the sum of the errors is fixed, like 5% or whatever, or 10%, right? So then the question is, if you can sort of make a decision whether you want to have more type 1 or type 2 errors, right? So then a neutral accounting system would argue that type 1 and type 2 errors are of similar size. A very conservative accounting system would be, and I sort of go back, that you report good high earnings only if it's really good and if it's very high chance that it's good, which means the type 1 error would be very low. The type 1 error would be high, but the type 2 error would be very low, right? So you want to avoid type 2 errors as much as possible, all right? That would be very conservative. In case of doubt, report low. Only if you have really sort of convincing evidence, then you would report high, right? So that will go type 2 error, very low, type 1 error, relatively high. If you do aggressive reporting, then the sort of reverse of that would occur. And the key here is it looks like, you know, conservative seems to be good in this sense, right? But there is a cost to it. And the cost is if the type 2 error is low, but type 1 error is high, then if we see low earnings, we don't learn that much about the type. If we see, on the other hand, high earnings, we are pretty sure that this is sort of an A type, because only the A type can produce the X. All right? So we have two things, essentially, and this is what I have on this slide. It increases, so if you have high conservatism, that will increase the probability of reporting low earnings, right? Report high earnings only if there's really convincing evidence to have that. On the other hand, it decreases the information content of the information. And to give a sort of a class room example, suppose you have an instructor and there's sort of a stringent or liberal scoring policy on exams, all right? So if the instructor is very stringent, right, then it's almost impossible for a low-ability student to score high, but it would be a good chance for a high-ability student to score low, right? So if you observe high score, then you're pretty sure that this must be a good student, but you don't learn that much from a low score. On the other hand, if you have a very liberal policy, most high-ability students would score high, but also a lot of low-ability students would score high. So then you get the information content on the low one, because then that's obviously the really bad people, right? Right. So we got probabilities and we got precision. And these two things are very different, right? And what I'm going to show here is how these things work out very differently. So essentially, the argument would be, while conservatism looks pretty good, It has a cost, and also aggressive looks bad, but it also has a benefit because it changes the precision of the information that we can receive. So let me briefly go over the So I have special cases, and then I show briefly the general case to develop the argument here. So suppose we ignore monitoring by the board. So the board makes a decision based only on the accounting information, right? That would be if the board is really inefficient or is rather looking at advising and no monitoring, for example, right? Then we got sort of only two signals. If there's high earnings, then we always retain the manager, obviously, because it should be the probability that the high manager is pretty good then. And if we have low earnings, then we need to figure out, is the information signal pretty strong or pretty accurate? Then we would replace the manager. But if it's not that sort of good in terms of precision, then we will still keep it, right? But assume that we remove the manager, right? Then the question is, what would be the optimal accounting system here in that case? It's aggressive, interestingly. And the way it works here is there's a cost of replacing a manager, right? And the interesting thing is if you remove the cost of replacing a manager, then actually it doesn't matter for the wealth of the firm, in a sense, because precision and probability of obtaining a certain signal exactly cancel out each other if there's no cost to that. So you could do aggressive or conservative. It wouldn't matter. So the only thing that really matters here is that it's costly to change the manager. So in order to reduce that cost, but keeping the accuracy constant, right, we want to have a sort of the lowest probability of having a low signal, because that's the trigger for replacing a manager, right? We don't change the priors. Right? So essentially, aggressive accounting minimizes the probability to receive a low signal. And this is perfect because that's the time when you remove managers, right? And you want to have that. And we don't change accuracy. So this is sort of a special case, in a sense, where these two forces exactly cancel out. But there's a cost to one of those two. And obviously, we shift in order to reduce that cost. All right? The next case is always monitoring. So the board always monitors. So if the board is actually monitoring, then it figures out the type of the manager with high probability. And the problem here is if the board is ineffective in monitoring. So if the board doesn't find out what kind of manager that is, right? Then we basically fall back to the same situation, and we still want to have aggressive. Because it doesn't matter if the board always monitors whether it's good or bad information. If it always monitors, then it's not useful for that decision. So if the board is not effective in figuring out the manager, we are basically back to the situation I explained before. Right? So still aggressive. So you always have aggressive now. The interesting situation here occurs in the general case where you have both. We have information from the accounting system that's pretty useful, and we have board monitoring, so that the board monitoring decision is made dependent on the accounting information, right? And there are again two cases. I just go over the one and the other very briefly. So the main result here is actually that the accounting system switches to conservative if the monitoring efficiency is high. And this is exactly what we want, and that's what we observe in the empirical literature. So if monitoring efficiency is high, then the board wants to have conservative information. All right? So why is that the case? So basically, if you look at this, is a situation where the board always retains a manager if it doesn't get information of the type, right? Because the accounting system is not that useful to make a decision on the retention decision. So without board monitoring, you always retain the manager. So the only concern of the manager of the board is what can he do? The default kind of thing is keeping the manager, right? So the only thing what it can do is if it observes a bad signal, the low signal, then it can make an investigation, figure out sort of a B type, and then replace that manager, right? Right, and so if one considers that, then obviously it's important to get sort of all the bad types basically into the low signal, right? So essentially, you want to have most of the B types in there where the low signal is, and then you effectively monitor those, right? If you do it otherwise, like aggressive accounting, then you have all the B types in the high signal, and so if you look at the low signal, you don't have very much effectiveness, right? So essentially, the whole thing switches because what happens now is the monitoring cost, and the monitoring cost again depends on the prior probability of the signal, right? So essentially, and that only works if monitoring is not too expensive. If monitoring is very expensive, then we switch back to the aggressive one, right? But this is sort of the key structure, and this is just an illustration for those being sort of formally inclined, I guess. So the expected profits on the vertical axis, and if we look at the cost of monitoring from being zero to being high on the right-hand side, then obviously each strategy and the lines are basically strategies of monitoring decisions. Do we always monitor? Do we only monitor for the good signal or monitor only for the bad signal? And then we get those lines. Obviously, the higher the cost of monitoring, the lower the expected profit to the firm. And the key part here is the black line up there, which is the monitoring for low earnings and conservative reporting. And this really dominates for low costs of monitoring, because you want to shift all those types to the low earnings part. If the cost gets really high, so boards are not very effective in monitoring, then we switch to aggressive accounting. All right. There's a general case for very accurate accounting systems, that the main difference only is that without monitoring down there in the intuition, the board retains the manager for the high earnings, but would replace the manager for low earnings. So this is a different decision here, right? It's because the accounting information is strong enough to replace a manager for lower earnings, right? And so this changes the decision somewhat, but essentially the basic trade-off sort of keeps the same. And we see with sort of strong boards and board monitoring, if that's pretty good, then we want to have conservative accounting. If the board monitoring is not that good, we go for aggressive accounting, all right? So this is sort of what the modeling tells us, and sort of to wrap that up with some empirical predictions. The first observation is neutral accounting systems never pay off. It's always good either to go sort of high up with conservatism or high up with aggressiveness. So neutral has no meaning here, in a sense, because we look at cost of type 1 and type 2 errors, basically, and trade off these two kind of expected costs. So if one looks at the solutions and then figures out what will be empirical sort of regularities that we would expect to observe here, we see, and this is sort of, as I said, the main result, if we have more effectiveness in monitoring, then we have conservative boards, or if the board is conservative, our accounting is conservative if the board is very effective. And if the cost of monitoring is very low, then we also usually get sort of higher conservatism. If it's more accurate, then it's not that clear what happens because we have the different types, but one can also argue or say that it's more likely to be conservative. We can also look at predictions on productions and manager markets. If the outcome of the production process is higher, then we want to have more conservatism, which is also something one can test empirically. Or if the cost of replacing managers is lower, you want to have higher conservatism. And we also get management turnover increases with conservatism because you have more triggers for that decision. What I was talking about now was a very simple structure. And obviously, this doesn't explain practice, because practice is very multi-folded in many respects, but one can sort of really extend those things. And just a few comments on extensions. One could look at board monitoring and board advising. And supposing these two tasks are substitutes, because either you have the monitoring types on the board or you have the advising types on the board, like external, you know, all these kind of people, then you get a trade-off between those two. Advising helps trigger good decisions in strategic decisions, for example, but it would lower the effectiveness of monitoring. So if the effectiveness of monitoring goes down, essentially, or it makes it more costly, then we would have less conservatism here, for example, right? If we get more advising. Or one could look at sort of board incentives, and I was talking about asymmetric loss functions, for example. So the board is not rewarded for good performance very often, but held liable for negative performance, right? So for the non-executive board members, that's often the case, right? What would happen with the accounting system in such a case? Well, there's incentive to avoid retaining a type B manager. So actually we want to minimize type 2 cost errors, right? Which again increases conservative accounting. If you have this kind of asymmetric loss function, we want to have more conservatism here. On the other hand, one can look at another sort of situation where the board is concerned with reputation to making good decisions, right? And that the problem with that is that the board hires the manager up front, right? So if boards hire a manager and then have to release them, this is like we made a wrong decision, right? So you want to avoid that as much as you can, and then it want to have less conservative economy because that increases the probability to replace a manager. Or boards may be friendly, like the dependent kind of boards, and try to avoid replacing a manager, then obviously we get the same kind of result here. So here are some of the studies that are consistent with that. And there are several studies that look at certain aspects of corporate governance and argue that stronger corporate governance is associated with more conservative accounting. And as I said, I mean, there is not much of good examples why that would need to be the case. And so what I tried to present here was one sort of structural rigorous argument why that would be the case in this. There's other literature also that shows that it's much less clear. And obviously, it really depends on what do you think is a strong board characteristic and these kind of things, right? So there's a lot of measurement kind of issues going on. So let me conclude with two slides on sort of some future directions. What would be management accounting and conservatism here? One could really look more into the functioning of board of directors, right? So the idea here is what a lot of literature looks at is there is sort of managers and shareholders, right? And the board is somewhere in the middle. Right, and the board might have sort of certain inherent kind of effects, right? Responsibilities, one can shuffle those around. What's the work of committees relative to boards? And we were talking about that in the morning. So, I mean, I'm coming from a country where we have this kind of dual board systems, and so this is kind of an alien discussion, what we have, what I see very often, if you have committees with the independent directors type of thing, right? That's what we usually have anyway. But collective decision-making, right? How does it work in board meetings? And who starts first talking, you know, or arguing? What should be the board composition, incentives, and also the composition of the board. What's the role of advisors? We've seen those particularly recently with the compensation committees. They look for advice and to peer groups and all this kind of stuff. So what's their role and their interaction with that? Specific information demands of boards. What internal reporting should look at? What should be reported? What would they need? And I guess the point I try to make is that the answer to that question would really depend on what other information the board can get, because the information sort of interacts with those, right? Endogeneity of governance and accounting, as I said in the beginning, or stressed in the beginning, there are some mechanisms that obtain sort of the same kind of objective, and what are their relative costs and benefits? I'm not sure we have a lot of good arguments on costs and benefits of those things. What are the economic factors to determine the optimal mix of those things? You know, pushing hard on performance compensation kind of thing, performance-based compensation, or providing different kinds of information. How does regulation affect the demand for accounting information to boards? And obviously the performance measures per se, I mean, that's sort of a big kind of deal here, compensation for senior management, for example. All right, so that would be sort of a lot of questions one can look at, and I find this is pretty interesting, I guess. You notice I did not try, I was reacting to a joke at the beginning, so I guess I'll, and the reason is I'm pretty aware that joking in a foreign language is kind of hazardous and dangerous to some extent, but I sort of have one at least at the end. That's like, if you can't read it that well, the board is very disappointed in your performance as CEO. The employees aren't even sending you hate emails anymore, right? So that's a very different kind of performance measure, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you, Ralph, very much. I'm reminded of all those firms I've seen where no manager wanted to take on a failing business unless he was going to push the prices up and really run it into the ground. I mean, that's what you're talking about, isn't it? Mm-hmm. GEC once over. Anyway, questions?
Hi, Gregory Yin, London Artscom Limited. Are you a professor?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, professor. Very interesting talk, very challenging, I must say, in all your slides, and you made lots of statements which are challenging to me. I mean, you know, I'm not sure about the others, but it's quite a warm day now. I'd like to just pick on something which yeah, this one here, where you say stronger corporate governance are associated with more conservative accounting. How do you define conservative accounting? Please, because, you know, we're all accountants here, and, you know, what could be conservative to you could be, you know, aggressive to me, you know.
All right, thank you. Yeah, fair question. I mean, as I sort of stressed in the presentation, there's a lot of empirical measures to figure out what conservative accounting would be in the data. But obviously, people have different sort of views and perspectives on those. To give sort of a glimpse on what the typical measure in archival data is like. So if you look at all those financial reports, you know, in a database and then try to figure out is there a conservatism going on or not. So it's mostly interpreted in terms of timeliness of bad news. So that you recognize bad news early and good news pretty late. And there is a Bezu measure, particularly there's a paper, I think it was JE 97 or so, that's sort of the basis of many of those empirical tests that looks at sort of the price reaction on bad news. So if you have it turns it around, but so the argument would be if there is bad news and markets pick it up, and you got sort of a declining price, for example, then the question is how does the accounting system pick that up? And if it picks it up pretty quickly, then we have conservatism. And you do that relative to the good news stuff. So if you have a price increase, market price increases, right? And you look at whether the earnings have gone up. And there you see sort of a kind of kinked line, essentially, that markets are pretty, or the accounting system is pretty quick in picking up bad news, but less quick in picking up good news. And you look at this sort of the angle and the slopes of those two, and this will be the measure of conservatism. So it's more like, as I said, a question of timeliness, of information that's being in that design sort of picked up by prices, that's an assumption, and one can argue about that. And then how does that sort of be reflected in the earnings, right? There are several other measures like market-to-book kind of things. Market-to-book ratio in a sense that if you're very conservative, then you add those up in the financial statements, in the balance sheet, essentially, and the equity goes down, but the market price is still up, right? All right, so I mean, but this is sort of a rare, very crude measure because it picks up growth options and all the kind of stuff as well. But that would be the way to do it.
Thank you very much, Alfred. It's very interesting. As you may know, perhaps, there's a growing body of literature in law schools in the United States and France possibly in the UK as well, which argues that the shareholders are not the owners of corporations. So the question then would become, what would happen to agency theory literature if that were the case?
I must confess, I just wrote a chapter for a book on agency theory, so I was pretty worried about exactly these kind of issues. And one thing would be to argue that any group has sort of some objective, whatever that is. And obviously, I mean, I'm coming from a country where stakeholder kind of theories are much more prevalent, and also basically in the law, rather than sort of just shareholders or narrowly shareholders. But agency theory, I guess, is almost new. I mean, depending on the way you deal with it, but it's very often pretty neutral. You can add other objectives as well. So essentially, the argument why shareholders would be in the sort of prime interest of many of these models is like that one can assume very often that other groups have sort of fixed stakes in the firm. And you look at this residual, and the residual would be what the shareholders are picking up, in a sense. And since you have been, and many people are, I think, will be interested in the efficiency in the firm's operations in total, then you need just one residual sort of group, right, in a sense, and that would be your measure. It doesn't mean that this is more important than all the rest. So one could even argue if the others have fixed claims and you can sort of still satisfy those claims, these are more important because the rest falls what's ever left, right? So one can sort of argue about the weights, and it could be even that if you have fixed claims, then that will be sort of the more important stakeholder group. But obviously there are a lot of problems with that argument as well, particularly, I mean, even if you look at debt holders, for example, and you have bankruptcy or employees, right, and you have bankruptcy, there's a lot of things at stake. So these things work very nicely if you don't have bankruptcy, because then you have the fixed stakes, right? But otherwise, they got variable as well, and then you have additional issues there.
Alfred, good afternoon. Simon Preece, civil servant. My question relates to your definition of responsibility of the board, where you're here saying monitoring and advising. I'm thinking more along the lines of setting objectives and controlling. You're talking about measuring a manager, chief executive, who is obviously not a member of the board, over whom the board has control, and who's monitored on the rise and fall of one's performance in terms of, say, a related KPI, such as, say, earnings per share. The thing is that the individual concerned has no real control over the objectives set by the board, and is therefore unfairly being monitored, because the objectives and the direction should be controlled by the board, not by the manager. If you keep replacing the manager, you've got to consider the impact it has on the other elements of the workforce and on the creditors and other stakeholders that are involved in this. So I'm a little bit confused about responsibilities of the board in this instance. Thank you.
All right. I mean, that would depend on the delegation of responsibilities to different groups, and we've seen sort of the triangle and the circle up there. And the question is, who is responsible for setting objectives, in a sense? And I mean, your argument essentially would go that the board sets these objectives and management sort of follows up, and then being sort of performance evaluated on those objectives for which they can't do anything about, right? And who sort of controls the board in a sense? I mean, that, yeah, I agree with that. I mean, so the main thing here is, I guess, what I was saying about the board being as intermediary between shareholders and the management. And so then shareholders would try to or should probably try to get more influence on board composition and getting people there and trying to influence what kind of objectives would the board basically choose before.
Given all the banks are sitting on enormous great bad debts, and you would think, we suggest that there may be other reasons why firms don't use conservative accounting.
Well, sure. I mean, there's a lot of different reasons, I guess. One would have... I mean, that's the beauty and the problem with analytical models, right? as you know. I mean, one looks at sort of one situation, tries to come up with an interesting trade-off, but it doesn't tell you this is the way reality works. It's just one story, and there might be conceivable many different stories. And I think it's more like an empirical task, after all, than to figure out what kind of story works in a certain environment more, or what is more explanatory relative to many others. But I agree. I mean, there's definitely a lot of things. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you.
Can I thank Kate? Would you please come back at 22? Thank you. Right. Okay, can we get on again? This is our panel, but that doesn't mean that you are meant to sit and listen for very long to them. It means that they will each say a word for about 5 minutes, and then we'll open up for general discussion. Everybody apart from Gillian, you've come across already. When Gillian is not looking after lost bags, she's the head of corporate governance at SEMA. I don't think that means she's the head of SEMA's corporate governance, but rather she looks at corporate governance for SEMA. So, now we haven't actually said who's going to start in 5 minutes. Mike, would you like to do so?
Thanks very much. Right, well, I'm sort of going to take my academic hat off and turn, talk to you as a NED. I suppose I sort of started that this morning. And so I'm the NED of St. James's Place, just outside the FTSE, worth $2 billion. They were this morning, who knows. I wanted to talk to you about sort of four themes. The sort of very, very personal, quite anecdotal in that respect. But really the sort of the NED perspective on managerial accounting, management accounting, and then some three sub-themes there really to do with the audit committee and the financial accounting, management accounting interface, and then management accounting information and business model visibility, risk and control. So the kind of the broad perspective as a board member is I don't really distinguish between management accounting and other information. So what's really important to me is managerial information in general, as well and external sources of information. And indeed, the financial regulator is putting a lot of pressure on people in my position to be sure that we've got the kind of information we need to govern that problematic term, the organisation. So managerial accounting information is a kind of subset of general MI. Where you draw the line, I don't know. But I've got a kind of very non-academic, pragmatic way of thinking about it, is that the managerial accounting information is the stuff that is owned by the finance department in the organisation. They're the sort of owners and responsible for it. And a lot of other MI comes from other bits. So the question I have about managerial accounting information is, does it provide me with a kind of window, an overview on how the business is run? So it's a kind of information in Alfred's sense, but it's also a signal in the same kind of information economic sense It's a window on managerial quality as well. I think Alfred was sort of talking about that. And I think that's actually very, very real. So the quality of the CRO leadership of the finance function is revealed through the quality of the kind of managerial accounting information. So as a NED, the kind of questions I'm interested in is how does the managerial accounting information, whatever it is, budgeting, costing information, get discussed and challenged within the finance team? And how can I get a handle on the health of that process? So I kind of see it as a kind of responsibility system, but not quite in the sense of the managerial accounting literature. So the big questions there are really, for me, what kind of managerial accounting information should help me at the level be a good principal? Be a good principal in a principal-agent situation, because it's obviously not the same level of granularity as elsewhere in the organisation. And in a way, that reverses the responsibility. I see it as the responsibility of the finance department to make me into a good principal and supply me with the managerial accounting information that I need. So, and that gives me reassurance about the finance function and about the first order activities of the organisation. So on the audit committee, we tend to think of audit committees, the financial accounting is the big job. Well, I can tell you it's a kind of outcome of what we do, but actually the managerial accounting, the integrity of the information feeds into the financial reporting process, not all the accounting standards and all that stuff. I mean, you can get someone to do that for you, but really the integrity of those information feeds is very, very important. So managerial accounting information is very important in that sort of feed chain, if you like, into external reporting. And of course, there's a long history of discussing the kind of disconnect between business models and what's really going on in sort of cash emergence, managerial accounting and financial reporting, and how those bits fit together is actually, I see, is sort of my responsibility is to figure that out and to get help. So on business model visibility, what's really important is sort of cost revenue behavior. It's a sort of standard first year accounting stuff. You know, how do costs behave over growth projections that we may have? And in that respect, you know, I'm involved in quite detailed ABC conversations with colleagues. Net cash emergence, NEDs need to understand the sort of business model and how cash emerges. I tend not to think of fixed and variable costs, more that sort of costs that are really to do with the current period and costs which have some investment for the future characteristics. And they're not always easy to kind of separate those. But costing information and costing discussions are clearly very important. And of course, my particular organization very much operates as an extended enterprise. There's huge supply chains. And what that means is that business model involves transforming fixed costs into variable costs. And one thing we have to keep vigilant about as a NED is whether that actually works, whether you are actually transforming those fixed costs into the variable costs. And how they behave over time, whether and what they vary with, which is obviously an expert issue for all of you. And behind that, I think there's a kind of always a puzzle for the conservative non-executive director is making sure that control investments keep up with growth and match growth. And we know historically they absolutely don't. You know, we don't invest in control systems, including management accounting, refinements, etc., as businesses grow, and that's why a lot of organizations are in bit of a mess. So it's that disjunction or conjunction between the managerial accounting world and investments in improvement in sort of control-related activities there and the actual economic parameters of the organization. So, I'm a sort of very prudent kind of biased NED in that respect. But the sort of big issue is, does the managerial accounting information make the business model, make the nature of cash generation really visible to, I would say I'm an amateur, but actually I'm probably not regarded as one, but certainly in the field of managerial accounting. And just finally, Michael, in my 5 minutes, sorry to run over, there's the whole dimension of the relationship between managerial accounting and risk and control information. And I know CIMA is very, very interested in this issue and has various research projects, and it's a big agenda item. I have a very, very kind of pragmatic issue on this. What is the Venn diagram overlap between managerial accounting type information and key risk indicators? There clearly is, because a key risk indicator is just probably some kind of performance metric with some variance added to it, and therefore those could be margins, they could be cost behavior, anything like that. And so what is the kind of intersection between what you might call variance thinking and tolerance and the managerial accounting system? Does the managerial accounting system is it designed to provide leading indicators of trends in the business, or is it still just historic? It will depend on a number of things, but those are the kinds of questions. And in all of this, I think it's not just about information, as I said this morning, it's also about relationships. So lying behind the actual cost data, budgeting data, variance analysis, etc., is the relationship between the chief management accountant, if that's the person, and the risk functions. And I think there's a lot of evidence that those conversations are becoming more proximate and development of joint indicators. And I know in some other work that I've done, chief financial officers are much more engaged in the risk management world, and this involves creating these interfaces between managerial accounting and risk management. So very anecdotal, very impressionistic, but just a series of personal reflections on the significance of management accounting as a part of the information set that enables me to function as in this strange governance role that one finds oneself in.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Hopefully I'm going to pick up on quite a few of those points. My starting point is actually the overall purpose of corporate governance as set out in the UK Corporate Governance Code, which is to facilitate effective entrepreneurial and prudent management that can deliver the long-term success of the company. So that's quite interesting because governance and management are brought together there. Now, we've had really just over 20 years of the formal corporate governance regimes, and for a lot of that time, the emphasis has been on putting the right structures in place and committees and so on. But what I want to argue today is that corporate governance has now arrived at that point where management accounting practice has the most to offer. In fact, I think it's important that it does if we are to fulfil the purpose of corporate governance as I just set out. Back in 2004, post-Enron and WorldCom and all that, CIMA did some research with the International Federation of Accountants to try and understand why debacles such as Enron and WorldCom had happened. And we looked at nearly 30 companies across the world. And one of our key conclusions was that boards had proved ineffective in the way they were overseeing strategy and risk, that their conversations weren't happening at the level and content that they needed to happen. So at that time, what we did, we were trying to see how we could address this, and we came up with a framework, which was the CIMA Strategic Scorecard, to try and address this. And really what we were trying to do with it was create a way for the boards to ask the right questions around strategy and risk. So it was really based on this idea of the board having a job to challenge constructively. And what we've found is really more recent events and the global financial crisis and all that sort of thing have really served to reinforce those conclusions. And there's a lot of evidence now that, a lot of comment out there that boards really need to raise their game as to how they oversee strategy, how they oversee risk, ask the right questions and so on. And in fact, what we've got now is the forthcoming review of Turnbull where they're picking up on some of these issues about what information boards get on risk and what's the nature of the conversation and so on. So where does management accounting fit in to that? We've had quite a bit of conversation about that today. Really what we're saying with governance is what boards need to do is to improve the quality of their decision making and their oversight. And for that, they need the right information presented in the right way. I'm going to go right back to 1919 now, when CIMA was founded by Lord Leverhulme. And he did so because he felt he didn't have the right information to run his business. So for me, there's a very obvious connect between management accounting and governance. So that's why I believe we've reached the point in the governance debate where management accounting can really step up. And management accountants need to really understand their role in facilitating discussion and dialogue to support boards in their decision making. And boards need to make really effective use of their meeting time so you get the right people making the right decisions using the right information. But my point is, though, that management accountants need to think very hard about the nature of information they present and how to assess the effectiveness of it. I would argue that the criteria for what constitutes good might look quite different from the information used within the business on a day-to-day basis. And that's where I think management accounting practice could fall down if it doesn't take the different needs of the boards into account. In particular, to accommodate the fact that boards have much less time together to operate as a team compared to the executives who are there together all the time, and they have very crowded agendas. I'd also add that attitudes about the role of the board matter. I feel that management needs to regard the board as having the potential to add value rather than a nuisance to be kept quiet. Just give them lots of information and hope they won't sort of kick up a trouble. So I would definitely agree this whole point about relationships really matter, relationships between the board and the management to make sure that the outcome is constructive. Of course, some information that you will provide will be there to help the board fulfil its monitoring role. You know, you want to make sure the board needs to know that the risk management processes are in place and things are done when things are going wrong. But what I'm talking about here is the more strategic information, characterised perhaps by the leading indicators, the non-financial and forward-looking information, the understanding of the business model, where value is created and destroyed in the business. All these things are the things we say management accountants are good at doing. And then, I'm not so sure the purpose is to provide assurance. Rather, I would contend that the purpose of this information is to provoke debate and constructive challenge. You might need to set out to disrupt the board and make it feel decidedly uncomfortable. But then you'll know it's awake, and it's curious, and it's engaging in strategy. And in that instance, maybe the role of the management accountant is to light the touch paper. Maybe that goes against our grain of wanting everything to be neat and orderly, not lots of nice information. So what I would argue is this: you should measure the quality of the management accounting information, or should I say governance accounting, I'm not sure, by whether it passes the curiosity test, by the quality and robustness of strategic discussion it creates, and then leading to effective decisions and action. So, thank you very much.
Right, I'd like to sort of start with a broad picture comment. In my view, and I did quite a bit of management accounting over the past couple of years, management accounting sort of had its high times during the 80s and 90s, but then basically financial accounting took over, in particular in research interest over the last 10 years or so. And I guess the main reason for that is that financial accounting has been driven by regulatory impetus coming from international accounting standards. So this adoption of new standards and the development of the new standards, IFRS, and the regulation around it, capital markets regulation, have provided sort of a very rich field for research that is both relevant and interesting for many people at that time. Management accounting, on the other hand, was kind of missing such an external shock that would draw attention for it over quite some time now. But I guess I see corporate governance being such an exogenous shock to the research environment, at least. Particularly the developments in corporate governance have had a strong impact, I guess, on many management accounting research questions over the last couple of years, and it sort of is regaining attention among researchers. One can also see that, particularly in Europe, I guess. I mean, the U.S. management accounting is sort of, at universities, is sort of dying out at the moment a little bit, and one reason might be that sort of the impetus and the need from practice is kind of missing, which is very different, I guess, here. And as I said before in my presentation, I think corporate governance and management accounting are really very closely related, and both sort of arise out of a way to control and mitigate agency problems inherent in companies. And basically, if we sort of look at sort of many of those management accounting mechanisms that we know and use, one is sort of providing information and transparency, which is financial information to the board, to the managers at various levels in the hierarchy, how disaggregated or granular information you would get to different levels in the hierarchy, additional reports that draw attention to certain pieces, how to provide that information, right, to draw attention to the main issues rather than providing sort of just many numbers. There are lots of organizational design issues that management accounting is concerned with. Delegation of decision rights, for example, responsibility accounting, controls, control systems, even compliance would be something that's pretty much related. And then sort of the big area of performance measures and management compensation structures, and particularly the interaction between sort of a diverse set of measures, financial measures, non-financial measures, lead indicators, inclusion of risk measures, as Michael was talking about. What do caps to compensation and deferred compensation mean for the information that we use in performance measures, for example? So I guess I'd like to sort of briefly comment on one additional thing, and this is sort of related to what I was talking about before, which is that the case of unintended consequences of certain mechanism design issues. And I would like to sort of give you briefly two examples that sort of relate back to management accounting issues and come from corporate governance stuff. One would be the increase in liability of board members or managers in general. So there's a basic intuition that most of us share, I guess, that an increase in personal liability of board members should be beneficial because it increases board incentives for monitoring. They care more about that, right? Or restrictions on D&O insurance will have sort of a similar effect, right? So the problem there with arguments like that is there is a significant counter effect. There is a paper by Volker Laux, for example, that looks at earnings management incentives there. So monitoring increases the detection of earnings management, but an alternative way to reduce motivation for earnings management is to reduce variability of executive compensation. Right? If you reduce the variability of compensation, the benefits of doing earnings management are lower, so people tend to do less. And this reduces earnings management incentives. But the problem then is obviously less variable compensation also reduces work incentives too in other areas as well. And that will be value destroying, for example. Second example is independence. There have been some papers around that look at sort of, do we want to have all board members independent? It looks like that the argument currently is like that. So independence is sort of a big deal, and independent board directors must notice that, and this is really bad, right? What many people would argue. And there are several sort of arguments. I just give you one. And that will be related to what I was talking at for the lack of commitment. Suppose you have a really independent board and that uses information on the fit of the manager too aggressively, right? Because it takes ex-ante views on those and makes inefficient replacement decisions that could happen. So anticipating that The manager anticipates what the board would do later on, given the information system. It would have to offer higher severance pay in the contract because there's a higher chance of getting replaced. And that's the way out to get the manager to accept the contract, right? So limiting severance pay, and this is what goes on in the European Union these days, right? Works against this potential benefit of having high severance pay, right? So there is a lot of interaction going on. So what we have here is ex-ante and exposed kind of issues with certain instruments, or there will be other examples as well. I guess I don't want to go into those, right? So to sum up, basically, what I think is that corporate governance discussions, and this is really driven a lot by examples or certain cases, and political will at the moment. I think what is important here for management accounting is there is a lot of regulatory requirements, and one can look at what effect does that have on management accounting. So does sort of board independence requirements, for example, change the performance measures that we use in contracts, the information that we want to give the board, for example. We would look at capital structure, financial arrangements, debt contracts, ownership of management much more closely, because that also affects the information demand of all the decision makers in firms. We could look at market discipline. I mean, there is a market discipline of agency problems out there, take over markets. I mean, this is sort of a strong incentive. And if one looks at those things, how does that interact with management accounting information, for example, or insurance to D&O and whatever. Or one could look at intermediaries like investment banks, financial analysts, and rating agencies that really drive. It's not just the budgets you use internally, but there is also some requirements coming from outside the company. So I guess what the corporate governance debate has brought to management accounting is to much stronger look at the outside and the environment of the firm, including capital markets, all the other mechanisms. And as I said before, I think this is really sort of a portfolio of different mechanisms, and they interact with each other. And this is very interesting, I guess, from a research perspective, and provides a lot of opportunities for management accounting research and also practice in the future, I guess. Thank you.
I don't have 5 minutes prepared, but I've got a couple of questions for you. It seems to me that as accountants, we're following a 500-year tradition of trying to account for the maintenance of economic capital one way and another. We're still arguing about how we do it best, how we present it best, what the principles are, but it's taken a long time, and we're still arguing about it. If you recognise that there are other capitals to be maintained in this world, then ask yourselves if the organisations in which you work and the profession to which we all belong have any responsibility towards the maintenance of those capitals. If your answer is that we don't have any responsibility, then we can have another debate another day, because I'm not your man to have that discussion. I personally believe that one of the main duties of governors of any organisation is to ask whether that organisation is performing in a sustainable way. And if your only objective is a financial objective, then maybe an economically sustainable way is good enough. If you believe that you have other responsibilities, or may develop other responsibilities in time, then please ask the question about those other capitals that you believe need maintaining. It seems that we're on a very long learning trajectory, and I don't think that we can start too soon. And I do believe that the framework that I was talking about earlier presents a means of approaching a start to learn for any organisation of any size or any nature. And I think it's never too early to start thinking about it myself, and I would ask you if you're doing it sufficiently.
Before we throw it open, I'm going to take advantage of being chairman and just say a word or two. We've talked today a lot about corporate governance. We haven't talked about the fact that in other countries, almost everything we do in corporate governance would be regarded as wrong. I know it's less fashionable now to quote the Japanese, but their view of corporate governance is basically you bring people in at the bottom of the organisation, they go through the organisation learning about it all, and if they're good enough, they end up on the board. And the other people on the board tend to be their suppliers, their bankers and so on, but they're not non-executive directors in the same way. Now, interestingly enough, fairly recently in Japan, the large companies have been given the opportunity to either carry on the Japanese method of corporate governance, which I guess many people would argue isn't corporate governance at all, or take on board some variant of the Western corporate governance. As far as I understand it, the voting was very strong. The great majority of Japanese companies wish to carry on Japanese corporate governance. Only those which were funded in international markets tended to move towards Western corporate governance. All I'm saying is that we have a view of corporate governance here, and that view is different. Indeed, it's different in Europe even, to a degree. I do have a slight feeling that this is one of the things that government tend to do. We've heard today, you know, the reasons why we have, well, before we had, I mean, I was so old, I was brought up without corporate governance. We had boards of directors who were in charge and the rest sort of thing. And really, the reason we have corporate governance, perhaps, is simply that there are an enormous number of corporate cock-ups, crises, and so on. So what does a politician do? Well, what a politician does is look around for something. And they looked around for something and they found corporate governance. Except, of course, it wasn't there. They had to make it up. You know, I'm sure this is all wrong. I realise that. But, I mean, it's the same as transparency. Do you remember transparency used to be the solution to all our crises? If there was a crisis, well, be transparent. Well, have you noticed that's disappeared? I mean, it's still around a bit, but nowhere near as much as it was. All I'm saying is, I don't think the people who invented corporate governance really had any sort of golden ideas in mind. It's been evolving. We've been talking about management accounting and corporate governance. And I think it's very clear that in my day, it was dead easy. Basically, at the bottom of the firm, you had non-financial information. The foreman had non-financial information. How many thingies had gone out? How many thingies were of appropriate quality? As you moved up the organisation, you had management accounting. And you forgot quite a lot about the non-financial information that the ones below had. And as you went up further, you had financial accounting information. That's what it seemed to me to be like. And I think, to a degree, there's still much truth in that model. There's still much truth in that model. What we have to do is clearly work out that financial information to the board doesn't capture everything. And moreover, it is very aggregated. Moreover, it tends to be backward-looking. One of the board responsibilities we haven't talked about much today is setting strategy. Strategy is about a future. Strategy is about the market. Strategy is about what your competitors, you think your competitors are going to do. Strategy is about what the you think the consumers are going to do and what they are going to do. There's very little of that in accounts. Similarly, we've always said that, you know, analysing financial accounts, you can find things about risk. Well, I mean, it's fairly clear that the sort of risk indicators in financial accounts, unless clearly it's a gross error, are not very good. Ratios are not very good. It's a bit worrying, actually, that the banks now are mainly controlled by ratios. Most accounting ratios, if you come for any lecture on accounting ratios, people will sort of say what the ratios are and then go on for a very long while about what's wrong with them. Banks are now controlled by those sort of ratios. Similarly, I'm a bit worried about risk as well. I don't know where risk is in financial accounts. I don't know where it is. I mean, I accept you can have a look and say this is, looks a bit risky and so on, but any formal sort of treatment of risk isn't there because, you know, the numbers in accounts are point, are numbers at a given point. Risk is about what things might vary. So all I'm saying is that I think there are a lot of problems about all this. Clearly, I think that management accounting information would be very useful because it's less aggregated. But you have to be very careful because managers manipulate information. So we need management accounting, but management accounting has to be rather more widely defined. It has to talk about the future a bit. In terms of cost structures, it needs to actually look at what cost structures firms really do have. Because if you at least use the standard textbooks, what you find is that the cost structure is enormously simple. Well, today has proved, I think, that all organisations are enormously complex. There's no reason to assume that accounting cost structures are not also very complex. So if we're basing our accounts and so on the very simple models, then we're going to get some weird answers. So that I think is some of the things that worry me a bit. I can see some solutions. I've heard some today. But I have a sort of, I still have this sort of slight feeling that corporate governance is a catch-all at the moment. It's not really, how can I put it? It's not really biting in organisations as much as perhaps it should. It's interesting that in the charity area, the roles of the trustees and the management are much more clearly defined, I think, than they are in the law. But anyway, these are just some random thoughts. That's why we have panels. Most of those are not things I actually believe, but I thought I would infuriate you a bit to make the debate go better. Right, shall we now try to have a discussion about management accounting and management accounting and corporate governance, new issues, new directions. Right. The subjects Al chooses quite often have that effect. Right. Where are we? There, sir. What we're going to do is either direct your questions to the individuals or, if it's general, that they may all wish to enter.
Okay, Professor. A question to you, Professor Gregory Yin in London Arts Corp. You mentioned something just now, and you said that management, I mean, I firmly believe, really, there shouldn't be a distinction between management accounting or managerial accounting and financial accounting. It's, you know, it's all part of the same thing, Paul, yeah, okay? It's how we analyze, dissect, and present information. And you said management accounting, the difference between that and financial accounting is that financial accounting is aggregated. But surely we all know that management accounting, when they are presented to the board, is usually aggregated as well because, you know, the boards don't have the time to look at details. I mean, we all know that in practice, the higher you go, the more aggregated the information gets.
Yeah, but the answer to that is that you need information that signals that you need to look at more detail. You know, if there's a if the aggregated information says there's a crisis in division X, then we look at the detailed information. So the detailed information is of fundamental importance, but clearly, you know, the old-fashioned principle of deception. You don't show the board vast detail if there's no need.
Don't want to give too much information to the board because there are too many questions.
Where do you work? Yeah. Yeah, well, there's more to it. I agree with that. I'm not sure I should be answering questions, really. Still, never mind. There's more to it than that. Enron's audit company had the best possible audit committee members you could possibly ever have. You know, everybody agreed they were the great and good and so on. As far as one can see, they didn't do anything. Now, that means if you take a sort of agency perspective, you're going to have some more mechanisms in there to make the committee, in this case the audit committee, but more generally, the board work better and ask the right questions. But that's actually very, very difficult to do. Right, where are we? At the back.
Thank you. David Otley from Lancaster University Management School. Can I try to broaden the discussion a little bit? Because basically my view would be that corporate governance is largely ineffective. Firstly, I don't think information is a huge part of the answer. There are many aspects where adequate information is available, but nothing is done with it. Take chief executive pay. In my professional career, the ratio of chief executive pay to median pay in organizations has gone up by a factor of 10. That is from 20 to 50 times median pay to 200 to 500 times median pay. That information is freely available, it's in the financial reports, and no effective action has been taken about it that I've noticed. Second, there has been, how can I put it, a loss of trust of the public in many large organisations. And this is based on their poor behaviour, you might say, in different ways. In most cases, it is not the case that senior management did not know about this behaviour. It is that they actively colluded in promoting much of it. I mean, there are exceptions to that, but that's not the bulk of the behaviour. And perhaps the fundamental problem is we've been applying the 1800s model of the limited liability company in circumstances that have radically changed. I mean, the global corporations these days are considerably more powerful than the national governments which supposedly try to regulate them. And where they're not bigger than the national governments, they seem to have co-opted the national governments into their pockets in various ways. So in this world that we appear to be living in, what are the things that can be done to govern organisations which appear to me anyway to have become almost ungovernable? An easy one to start with.
I don't know whether anybody wishes to... Comments? No? Julian, come on.
Come on, I'll have a go. I can't resist. I think it's quite... I just want to pick up on a couple of points, actually, the issue about corporate governance being ineffective, which I've got some sympathy with that view, because I think, certainly speaking from a very UK perspective, and having heard a kind of a leading chairman express this view, we've become a bit corporate governance junkies in Britain. We kind of, it's a little bit of a hobby, and maybe sometimes we've mistook the letter of corporate governance for the spirit. And I think that's possibly accounted for the fact that when we look at some of the more recent debacles, the key conclusion is often about poor behaviour. And I think that, in a way, I think to some extent information is... We can't discount the importance of that. And I wouldn't want to say, well, that's... You know, it's a waste of time even thinking about putting the right information there. But I think the other side of it as well is behaviour, both within the board and around the organisation. And I think that is really the most difficult question facing the governance debate at the moment. And unless we kind of face that one, include that in the conversation, I would tend to agree that the problem won't be solved. Corporate governance won't be effective by just good information. It needs the behaviour as well. And I was quite struck by listening to Sir David Walker when he was undertaking his review, and he just looked at everyone in the audience and said, this was all bad behaviour, like the headmaster saying, I'm going to keep you all in for detention. I think the problem is people know it, but I think there's a real fear about tackling it, because I know he, if you read the Walker review, at the very back of it, there's a report by the Tavistock Institute about behaviours on board and some of the psychological issues. And it's one of those things, you can read it, but I think it makes people terribly uncomfortable in terms of tackling behaviour. So I think that is the edge that we're at. But I haven't offered any solutions, but I do acknowledge that behaviour and the restoring of trust is a core issue, and we mustn't lose sight of that.
Just two brief comments maybe to your questions. I mean, you said information is there, but there is no effective action, or management colludes and these kind of things. When you look at the management accounting part of that, obviously since the information is there, management accounting has done its job, right? So it's more like a matter of who should take care of actions in this regard. And my guess is that transparency should empower the shareholders, for example. And this is what we observed to some extent, that somebody else, but not management accounting, for example, would take care of that. The other comment is on the global companies that become extremely powerful relative to countries. But the way to deal with that to some extent is that corporate governance has become globalized as well. I mean, so it's like the investors or CalPERS or whoever, so the big investors create their own ratings and all these kind of requirements that many companies would fulfill. I mean, the problem I see with that in some sense is that the measures, once you do this on a sort of global scale, become too crude and not sufficiently fine-tuned to many details in certain countries. So there is a cost to it, but I think something is happening in this regard.
There was one over there, if you remember. Oh, sorry. I've got them all going.
Well, no, I was just reflecting. I mean, I think one of the issues in David's provocation is we don't have many great corporate governance stories. We have lots of scandals, so we assume there's a systemic issue, but we don't have a similar body of stories of success. And again, very anecdotal. I mean, I think corporate governance is very episodic. And it's in a crisis or when things are going wrong that you know whether you've got a good board, whether it works, and all, that kind of thing. I've had three of those episodes in 8 years. Very episodic. And you are decorative. You probably are decorative for 30% of the time, active for the rest of it. And then you have these terrifying moments when you actually have to do corporate governance for real. So I think if we had an ability to talk about it in a more sort of complex way, if you like, and attend to the different rhythms of corporate governance, and when corporate governance moves from sort of routine world into a more stressed situations into crisis, when you get different capabilities kicking in, when you start to have 5-6 board meetings in a week, that sort of thing over an issue, then you know whether you've got a good corporate governance system in that organisation or not.
Just one additional comment, if I might. We talked about trust. Now, trust seems to me to be a key social asset, a vital capital of organisations that we have constantly ignored. We're reaping that particular harvest now because we've got no way of measuring it. We don't even try. But with big data coming along, we've got lots more available information. If we ask the question, our duty is to frame the questions so that information can be provided as and when it becomes available. We can measure trust. And if we ask the questions, we can start to measure trust and look at impact upon it. I believe we've destroyed huge amounts of trust throughout corporate Britain in the last decade or so, with no one taking responsibility for it, because we've not identified it as such. We can do that.
Thank you. What I'm going to do is take a couple of comments and not refer them back till after we've had a few comments. So, I think, if you can remember.
It was a question for the panel. I've personally been reading a little recently about the dismantling of the state that has been happening over the last 30, 40 years. And from what I can see from the speakers today, that corporate governance seems to be driven by shareholder value, which is often about short-term profits. And Martin, for example, talks about the requirement to maintain all capitals being then cultural, environmental, and economic. And the question that I have for the panel is, who should set the rules? Should it be markets? Should it be governments? Or should it be professional bodies? Or is there some other body that should be setting rules that would set the future for corporate governance?
Can you hold that in mind? We'll see if we've got one or two more comments. Sir, on the inside.
There's been a lot of discussion today about things like management accounting, corporate governance, and then also raising the questions from David Ottley and the most recent speaker about who should actually govern corporations. It's an interesting thing in France that they have two different terminologies which kind of are interchangeable, which is gouvernance des entreprises et gouvernement des entreprises. And when you look at the distinction there, it becomes quite obvious that there is a distinction, which is not present in English, that governance is actually the control of corporations, whereas corporate governance is actually more government. And that is, how does the corporation govern itself? And then when you bring in management control, you have the idea of a management accounting. So you have governance down, you have governance at the mid-level of the board, and then you have the governance by the state of the corporation. And we keep moving back and forth and back and forth, and it confuses the debate.
If there's one more similar comment on those, otherwise I'll let the panel say a word if they wish to. Oh, sorry. We got one more.
Can I just pick up on what Martin said about trust? I think there's two very different spheres where we talk about trust. One of them is an area where actually there shouldn't be any trust, because we should have systems in place, which means that we don't need to take the risk of trusting, if you like. And I think that perhaps some of the banks have shown that we as a nation have been forced to trust them, and actually we couldn't trust them. And there should have been more policies in place. Part of my job is the back office for the Treasury function in our organisation. And my job is to make sure that there is adequate documentation and support and backup and authorization for transactions that take place. So we don't trust anybody. We don't expect to trust them. We don't put them in the awkward position of being trusted, if you like. Everybody from the board of directors downwards knows that there are systems in place, which means that we don't have to take the risk of trusting, which works 99% of the time, but 1% doesn't. I think there's an argument for saying it's very important to distinguish between those areas which we can avoid trust by putting in systems that take place, and those areas
where... If I may respond to that, then I think what you're saying is that you trust the information and you don't trust the people. All the theories that I've read about trust say that trust needs to be reinforced by control. I mean, there's an Islamic saying that trust in Allah, but tie up your camels. And that's what it comes down to. So you are actually, by building your systems, which you trust, are able to reflect upon the people that are operating within those systems and identify those that you can trust and those that you can't trust. And I believe that trust is in multiple dimensions, and we can measure it and we can improve it. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't be monitoring and controlling abuse of trust. We certainly should. And to answer the previous question, whose responsibility is it to do that? And you quoted, you asked whether it's us or as a profession or the government or whatever. And my response to that is all of the above. We've all got a role in doing it. And so long as it becomes the non-disclosed, the non-discussable issue, we won't be addressing it. And I think that's a duty that we've got, is to ask the questions. We're not going to get perfect answers immediately, but that starts the learning process.
Anybody else? There's also the role of the state, I think.
Yeah, the first question actually is what I wanted to address. I mean, I kind of take your point. It's the sort of neoliberal argument, the state's kind of... withdrawn. We live in a more fragmented world with lots of norms and rules coming from, you know, loads of different places. You think about the bodies who are presiding over corporate governance. I mean, it's a long list, isn't it? All sorts of different rules coming out. So I can see, you know, the natural question is to say, well, who should really do it given this plurality? But I'll turn it around, actually, and I think, you know, if we accept that there is this... multi-normative world where rules are coming out of, you know, different levels and so on. Maybe the real issue is not where the rules come from, but their reception. In other words, how they get internalized and received. And there's quite a bit of research that shows that the same kind of rule, whatever it's about, the compliance is very, very different depending on whether the human agents experience it as some sense owned by themselves or coming from the outside, if it's experienced as being imposed versus experienced as being somehow in the self-interest. And I think, I mean, this relates to the trust point. I think normatively, if one takes that idea seriously, then what's at stake in setting rules for corporate governance is not just the writing of the rules, and it's not really sort of enforcement in its narrow sense. It is creating the experiences whereby the good bits of these rule systems become internalized. Now, that leads to that horrible word embeddedness, which gets used all the time in a horrible way, and I hate it, but it's kind of in that direction that one might go, rather than thinking of all these different centers that produce guidance for us in this area.
Anybody else?
I was going to add as well that I tend to look at corporate governance within a bigger system of law and best practice and so on. And in a sense, a good corporate governance regime can't exist without sort of almost strong political governance, so respect for the rule of law and so on. It also needs a strong company law framework where, you know, there are certain things that are embedded in law, and the corporate governance framework sits within that. So it's actually something I find quite a hard question to answer. What should be, you know, a rule, what should be best practice and so on. I think the line often changes, but I don't think I see it as an either or. There's a sort of both. And certainly some things sit better in law, whereas more the behavioural issues, you can't really legislate for those terribly easily. So I see it more in a systems way, within a context of a strong overall governance system.
Can I move on to another question?
I don't know if it's a question or further comment on the discussion. I think we have a call to be proud of as accountants, because I think the answer is in information, only because information is a necessary condition for corporate governance to have a chance. Now, I would also add that it's not a sufficient condition, because the information, however good it is, then needs to be acted on. Now, if you then refer to what Alfred said, transparency is part of that solution, because that gives stakeholders, let me call it that, at least the means to act, if they wish or choose to act. And it's the wish or choose to act that, for some reason, we haven't talked about, and I think it's maybe because it's an ugly word, which is incentives. But I'm using it slightly broader than executive pay or pay for performance. I use it in the sense of reuniting ownership and control. And those who have read the Walker Review should have noticed that actually quite a bit of the recommendations have to do with the re-engagement of the shareholder. And if you want to broaden that up to stakeholder, then you get back into issues of transparency. And in my view, these are much more tangible objects, if you'd like, than trust, because I think they can allow to reinforce trust or to act if you don't have the trust. So I would say, as accountants, we're in business because I'm not convinced that information is at least not a necessary condition. So that's good news for us. I believe it's not a sufficient condition, but transparency and trust. And I think we should not forget incentives, but not in a sense of pay for performance, but reuniting ownership and control. And it was Gillian who mentioned the law, and I think the legal scholars here, and we haven't really mentioned them a lot today in this forum, have actually a lot to say there, and we don't really connect much to that. But the information, I would disagree with David, is a very big part of the answer.
One last one. Yes.
Thanks. My thoughts have sort of been triggered, especially by Julian's comments on behavior and Michael's on the bandwidth. A concern I have to some extent is the almost an increasing obsession with data and analytics at the risk of maybe losing our sense of smell. And so there are a few things I'm interested in, and that is, How might you monitor the drift that takes place in that bandwidth, where indeed subgroups then go outside that safe operating envelope? And secondly, whether or not the managerial information team and that community should have what I would call white space in their plan, where they've got a certain amount of undefined time that they can roam around and actually discover what's really going on.
I'm not sure that's not a very nice way of ending. Thank you. Right, can I say thank you to our panellists? You're welcome to continue to discuss with them over tea and coffee, and of course the buffet in the evening is even more meant for discussion. Can you please be back by just before 5:15? The puzzle now is only to find your way back to where you started from this morning. Thank you very much.
Okay, good evening, everybody. We'll make a start on the final evening session. It's great to see so many familiar faces and new faces. I was working out this is my 9th MARG conference at the LSE. And that reminds me to plug the sister conference, which is in your packs, which is the Aston MARG event. So please do have a look at that and submit your papers as ICAW continues to support Aston MARG. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Rick Payne. I work in the Finance and Management Faculty at the Institute. And it's my honour to introduce Philip Gregory to deliver our Distinguished Practitioner Lecture. The report in your packs, plug time, Finance in the Broadest Sense, shows that chartered accountants have been contributing to business performance for well over 50 years. And in that tradition, Philip has also made huge contributions to the organisations he's worked at. My time at KPMG overlapped with Philip, but unfortunately our paths didn't cross at the time. And since then, Philip has undertaken board-level roles as CFO, CEO, and now as non-executive director. So he's seen governance from both sides, from the executive side and the non-executive side, so should be able to give us some great insights there. We're also very pleased that Philip serves as a mentor on ICAW's leadership development programme, and I think that's something that the mentees value, but Philip's also told me that he gets excellent value out of many of those sessions as well. So when I met Philip to discuss this year's theme, it was clear to me that his experience that he can draw on will enable him to provide some great insights for the conference. So please join me in welcoming Philip Gregory, who's going to provide some personal observations on the effects of changing governments on the finance function. I've stolen your notes. That was a good throw on my part, wasn't it?
Only if you don't take my speech away with you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. When I was asked to talk to you today by the ICAW, it was about the effect of changing governance on management accounting. Well, I did two things to that title. I crossed out management accounting and wrote finance function. I'm afraid, as a CFO, a CEO, I don't understand the distinction between management accounting and accounting. To me, when I first started in business in 1976, I understood it implicitly. When I went around to do my auditing, there was a management accounting team, there was a financial accounting team, and I understood it. I think somewhere in the travails of getting to where we are now, with huge electronic IT systems, with a big focus on data and information, the blur is so much, I find it very difficult to tell the difference. So I crossed out management accounting, put finance function. And I also stuck the qualification on there, some personal observations and experiences. A lot of you are academics. All my experiences are entirely random. Therefore, I may have just been unlucky and hit a load of random pointers and directions in one direction. But for what it's worth, I'd like to draw on my executive and non-executive experiences. But actually, interestingly, and Rick mentioned it there, the mentoring that I've been doing for the F10 course, just to explain that, the Institute put in a leadership development program in about 2 years, 3 years ago. mainly because the demand from the CEOs was that, hey, you, the Institute, are not producing the type of CFOs we want. And I'll come back to this a little later on, but we want people who can be our business partners in running this big organization. The non-execs are looking for us to have executive challenge. Sorry. Better? Yes? The non-execs are looking for executive challenge, and the type of person you're sending out is not there. They're very good at producing a set of accounts, they're very good at the accounting function and being a CFO, but actually that's not the type of CFO we want. And therefore we put mentoring into that, and I have now mentored 10 people who are either in their first year as a CFO or just about to be the main CFO, having done the divisional CFO. And actually, a lot of the examples I'm going to use for this talk have actually come from them, and some of their problems and some of their issues, a lot of that relating to corporate governance. Obviously, unfortunately, for you who are just getting ready for some good, good examples, due to confidentiality issues, I've had to change their names. No doubt if they look on the internet afterwards, they'll be able to work out which ones they are and not. Okay, what do I wanted to cover today? I just want to quickly deal with what I think are the main issues that CFOs are worrying about at the moment in terms of their role and where they fit within the organisation. I want to look then, secondly, at the changes that corporate governance is creating for finance. I want to look at the tensions between that corporate governance aspect and the other influences of what the rest of the organisation wants. Look at the different issues for different sizes of businesses, and then try and draw some conclusions. I mentioned in my preamble that what CEOs want is not what the institutes and the organizations are producing. The reason that most people get a CFO job is not the reason of what the CEO wants out of them in the future. You get the job because you run a good set of books, you produce good set of data. Increasingly, having got that, what the CEO is looking for is effectively a personal financial advisor to the CEO. And the challenge, as I said before, is that a lot of people are not suited for dealing with that. However, there's always, I think, been two different types of CFO out there. There's been the bookkeepers who are great for the statutory accounts, great for talking to the financial analysts and the market, and there's the partners who partner the CEOs. And one of the reasons we put this in your pack is a 1963 lecture by the finance director of Shell, whose thinking on what should a finance function do is fantastic, and I would say very modern. And one of the interesting points in his paper is that he says that his thinking developed from how it used to be done 20 years before, how trends had moved away from that, and it had all become about numbers, and how Shell had now decided that this was the way to do it. And I was talking to Rick, who says, well, Shell then now said that subsequently they moved away from that again, and they've now come back to the same answer. So please do read it. I'll work out the fact that obviously they didn't have IT systems there, so he recommends things like producing accounts every 3 months on the grounds that that's about as fast as it's possible to do. Ignore that bit, but the rest of it is really quite a good read. And one of the most comprehensive examples of how what a role of a CFO should be there. So there are always different types of CFOs out there. To illustrate that, I was given a paper that one of the chairman of the audit committee, one of my mentees, had been given. It was written by Lord Weinstock and basically is about as most dinosaur a version of what a CFO could ever be. And this non-exec was trying to suggest that my CFO should do that. So there's always been a tension there between being a financial executive and being an accountant. But definitely the move and the demands in the market is for people to be financial executives, and that is a considerable problem for a lot of accountants who are not very good at it. So that is there. Now, the consequence of that also, and this I think comes back to my point about the management accounting, is that increasingly what you're seeing is specialisation in the large accounting functions for the large corporates. You've got the number production is delegated often abroad to financial service centres. Tax and treasury is separate. And a new function that's appearing all over the place, either called something like financial business partners, decision support, etc. I think it's probably the management accountants having changed their names to be a little sexier and a little more modern. But actually, a very important function, and I think it's a complete career direction that some people are going, and often is the one that I think will in the future be the route to the top. Other things that CFOs are worrying about there, and we get up in the mentoring, obviously the difficult economic times is causing a lot of issues, and that requires that people need better and faster numbers. I think a lot of the debate today was about really large organisations which have good IT systems, etc. If you actually go into the SMEs and middle-sized corporate UK, the financials are pretty awful, and the time taken to produce accounts is dreadful, and the accuracy of those numbers there. And there's a lot of people in those areas who are desperately trying to get the numbers out faster, mainly because they've got the banks on their back. But also, too much of those functions have been quite simplistic and only been producing financial accounts. And the big issue out there at the moment is we want forward-looking data. In the words of my chief executive of Marsh, why is it that we're always running this business only looking in the rearview mirror of the car? Therefore, there's been a big move forward to find other data, which is often non-financial, in terms of what's going to help us predict what the numbers are, because I want time to be able to affect it. If I'm management, I want to affect it. I don't want the numbers just to tell me that I died last week. Equally, obviously, there's a lot out there going on about cost reduction, efficiency savings through pretty much another buzzword, straight-through processing. But actually, straight-through processing has been fantastic. It has taken huge amounts of cost out of the organisation. But along with it, we've got offshoring and outsourcing. Your lecture last year on this particular section was all about offshoring. There's a huge effort required in getting it in, but I think a lot of people have forgotten that once you get it in, that's only the start of your problems. A lot of my mentoring is getting people to work who have a lot of their financial information outsourced or offshored, getting the teams who are offshore to work with the teams who are onshore, and to get the sort of synergy that they would expect, rather than what you have is a sort of two tribes don't talk to each other, and there's a lot of finger-pointing going on. Now, you'll note that in my discussion of what are the hot points for the CFOs out there at the moment, I haven't mentioned corporate governance. Clearly a hot point for lots of people. Interestingly, one of the things I found is that there's a lot of lack of knowledge by particularly divisional CFOs, etc., of what does happen in a board. They've all, of course, read the 48 Companies Act. They've all gone through the organisation. But really, what really happens in a board is something that they only tend to find out when they get there. And consequently, we've had to actually put into the leadership development for the Institute a complete day's session on corporate governance to train the guys up before they get into the boardrooms, before they put their size 12 in it when they get there. And to show an example of that, I have one of my guys who we'll call Bill. Fantastic, worked for one of the big mobile telephone companies, ran a division financially, very good at business partnering, gets headhunted and moves off to be the top CFO at a big company. Gets there, looks at the business reporting, looks at the board processes, and decides it's all rubbish and he's going to do them a PowerPoint presentation instead. This didn't quite go very well. And mainly because he really did not understand that one of his big jobs and responsibilities as CFO was to provide the data for the independent non-execs. He really hadn't thought about it. He thought his job was what has always been in the division, which is supporting his CEO to get the yes decision from the main board guys that they went to see. So it is quite amazing that you get people making that mistake, but it's actually because there is no training given early enough on it. And if you're not actually at a boardroom table and sitting at a boardroom table and worrying about complying with the best corporate governance, then perhaps it's a bit theoretical doing other things might be better. So, major corporate governance changes, what has been the effect on the finance function? Well, firstly, boards, as we have actually had quite a bit of discussion today, have changed quite considerably. The majority of the board are now NEDs. When I first went on a board, 1986, FTSE listed, there were 10 of us executives and 2 non-execs. This had a great advantage. We could railroad absolutely anything through because we knew all about it. It was also helped considerably because the board packs typically consisted of an agenda, minutes of last meeting, a 3-page finance director's report written by me, and possibly one other sheet of paper. I do have quite a lot of respect for our 2 non-execs there, because they did a damn good job based on very little information and having to react pretty damn quickly to whatever we were saying. If you contrast that now, there is my board packs for a similar size FTSE listed company never comes in at under 200 pages. It always takes me 7 hours of reading just to get through it before I actually get to thinking. And the audit committee is pretty much similar. A consequence of that, apart from anything else, is that the postman cannot get it through my letterbox. So it now has to come electronically because it won't fit through the letterbox, which causes them lots of problems, as it then has to be encrypted because the FSA says it has to be encrypted, whilst it could be posted quite happily by the FSA, is quite happy that time, and it arrives in an envelope that's shredded, and the local postman is asking me about the very interesting factors relating to sales performance in Brazil, having had an interesting read coming up the drive. But on a serious note, a very important factor that CFOs and the finance function now have is the repository of independent data and the provision of independent data to the non-execs. And actually, that is slightly different from providing the relevant data that's needed for management. And too often, the CFOs are not thinking about it, but need to think about it and need to gear up for it. Secondly, typically, there are only the CEO and the CFO on the board these days. There often is one very senior director from somewhere else. That's good from the finance function. You have your shop steward at the top table. It increases the power of the CFO. It helps in cementing this role of being the right-hand man of the CEO. But actually, it comes with problems also. The NEDs are actually looking for the CFO to be challenging the CEO. And that's quite an interesting dynamic. On the one side, the two of you are going to the board meeting as a team to be united in for the benefit of the company. At the same moment, you're supposed to be cross-questioning him as you go in as to what's happening. It's also a situation, as we know, that the NEDs are typically having less relevant knowledge. The good news, I think, which is improving the gene pool within the NED community considerably, is that it's getting quite hard now, or almost impossible, for FTSE-listed companies not to headhunt the non-executive positions. So the days when meeting Fred in the club and suggesting that he might come onto your board and vote for you in exactly the same way as you'd like have definitely disappeared. The disadvantage that is obviously that there aren't enough necessarily good people there for the headhunters, and therefore they're having to be quite thinking out of the box in who they are. Therefore you're getting people coming in with marketing backgrounds from a completely different industry who don't know the industry that they're moving into. And that can be a problem. So one of the things and consequences that has for the finance function is not only do you have to provide the data and the independent data for the non-execs, you've got to present it in a way that somebody who hasn't spent the whole of his last 46 years in life assurance or banking or widget manufacturing, whatever it is, can understand it. I used to have a chairman, Lord Marshall of Leeds, who is no longer with us, but he actually thought that one of his wittiest criticisms of me was to say that my board reports read like a paperback novel. Even at the time, I said, that's very nice of you, Lord Marshall. I think that's a very great compliment. I'm trying to write my board reports to read like a paperback novel, because with our directors, if it doesn't read like a paperback novel, they won't have a clue. As you can see, I was a company that was dealing with local government at the time. But it is an issue, and one of the things I encourage the CFOs that I mentor is to not just send out the board report, but get round there and make sure you have a really good conversation with every single one of those NEDs a couple of days before you have the board meeting, because you want them to understand the issues absolutely clearly. You'll get far less hassle, you'll get a much easier ride as the finance director, and it's much better that they can ask the questions that they would be embarrassed to ask in the forum of the board to you separately, and then you can get value out of those people who, after all, you're paying a lot of money to sit on your board. I'm particularly pleased that one of the guys took my advice, because I've just got an email earlier on inviting me to phone him up and discuss the board papers, so he's obviously been listening to what I was mentoring him on and is doing a great job. Right. Secondly, unfortunately, you've got a lot of issues about all the NEDs coming on have been drummed into them due process. And worse still, not only must it be due process, but it's got to be really well documented. In fact, I would actually say that the NEDs are pretty much obsessed with going through due process, whilst actually, as we've already said, the executives just want a yes decision as soon as possible to their proposals, whatever they are. The NEDs are therefore particularly keen on a paper trail, and guess who within the organisation team gets to do the paper trail? And I can tell you it's not the CEO, so it must be the CFO. I used, when I was CFO, to be very good at writing papers for my CEO, and as soon as I became a CEO, I stopped writing all papers immediately and handed it over and told my CFO to do it. So it's increased workload, and the rest of the finance organisation will pick that up, and that is something that we've got to have there. Second, the other point about that is increasingly within the organisation, the CFO and the finance team are becoming important, along with the company secretary, as being effectively the internal conscience of the organisation. Does this have to go to the board? It's always a decision that the CFO, the finance function, have to do it in terms of matters reserved for the board. Mysteriously, people who run business divisions always forget this, and have often done it already before you actually discover it. Another major work stream that's come out of corporate governance is risk management. If you were on a board perhaps 5 years ago and certainly 10 years ago, risk management really was not a big issue. If you're on the board at the moment, risk management is a big issue. The NEDs are very hot on risk management. They know that it has to be there. Within the organisation, the risk management functions are being beefed up. It's gone normally from being perhaps a bloke who used to work for the CFO and probably did the insurances at the same time to two or three people. But whatever happens, the CFO and this finance function get very heavily involved in risk management. An important consequence of this is that, frankly, very little of the accountancy training that the CFO has had or his team have had actually tells them how to do risk management. And one of the things that the institutes, all the various institutes, need to consider is getting some really good risk management programs within their training and probably within their qualification, because it's going to become a big area. Right. Conflicts with other influences. A lot of this drive to corporate governance has been led and pushed through the financial services industry, through the FSA. And in fact, the FSA has effectively backed the ranch on it working, because they've concentrated so much through their arrow visits to do you have good governance. And their concept is if you do have good governance, you'll get better decisions and we'll have less disasters. What's that tending to result in is a push now for the finance function to go back to being more of a controlling function. Sufficiently so that the Institute have had to put on a course for the big banks' accountancy finance staff, because their concept is that the finance teams going round the business have a better understanding of what's really going on in the business than most other people. And we want them to be whistleblowers as to what is right and what is wrong within the organisation. Is there anything inappropriate happening? That's pretty difficult when, for the last 50 years, the finance team have turned up for quarterly reviews and have been beating people up for improving the return on investment, getting rid of costs, all those sort of things are suddenly going to expected to turn up by the banks and actually say, gosh, you're making too much profit in this area. We should do something about it. This is a corporate governance risk. So it is an interesting factor that the finance functions are being used more and more as a corporate policeman. It would be true to say that finance functions have always been a corporate policeman. They've always been the guardian of the control environment. But actually, it's quite different. And to some extent, we need to think about the interpersonal skills that the finance teams have and are going to need in the future if they're going to have that role. And actually, nobody's actually doing very much about the two major causes of all these ethical issues. It's either money or team. It's either the bonus system that's driving people to push the profits in a wrong way and forgetting the customer as they're doing it, or it's the loyalty to your team gets people to bend the rules in a way that results in corporate problems. So we've got quite a conflict going on out there in practice. Corporate governance is pushing the finance almost back to a traditional bookkeeping and control environment, whilst the CEOs are dragging the CFOs to become business partners and financial executives with them. I think probably also a lot of what we've been discussing today has almost been concentrated on 500 companies in the country. It's only really the big organisations that have this corporate governance in place and have these issues. They're very large organisations, they represent a huge percentage of the economy. But if you actually get there, out there into private equity-owned companies, you don't get the element of corporate governance. I've sat on three private equity-backed boards. And there's a completely different way of doing a board, a style of doing a board, an element of interest, what happens at the board, compared to a FTSE-listed company. Private equity are really very focused on how's their investment doing, what's the cash, what's the prospects for the future, and they're very much more involved in the company and they have a much better knowledge of it. So a lot of the traditional corporate governance that you've seen out of Capri and otherwise issues does not exist. Pretty much private equity boards will normally be all the executives and a couple of guys from the private equity houses. It's a very different model. And I have one of my guys who is CFO of a very, very large private-owned company. And that's completely different. The boss owns the company. He owns 100% of the shares. And frankly, he runs it as a private fiefdom and stuff corporate governance, and he has no interest in it. The problems that my CFO has is issues like the chairman coming into his office and saying, oh, I bought a new corporate aircraft last week. Could you please pay this invoice for £12 million? Well, he owns the company, so yes, what's wrong with it? The problem is, of course, they have a lot of bank debt in there. So there's some very interesting and difficult conversations for the CFO with the loan officers at the bank who say you must put pretty decent governance in. Well, frankly, sticking a couple of non-execs on would not have anything to do with how the chairman behaves. It's a behavioural issue. And I did a little equivalent of this speech to CFOs in Dubai. And they have exactly the same problem. It doesn't matter what they run the companies and how it is. The princes have to be on the board, and the princes decide how the company is going to be run. And actually, they own the companies as well. So, you know, I think we have to be careful in a lot of a debate today as to how relevant it is for quite a, for a large section of the economic community that's out there, the small companies, the private equity. And actually has been pointed out, subsidiaries of Japanese companies, subsidiaries of US companies, subsidiaries of French companies have a different models. And their ways of doing corporate governance is completely different. And as somebody who's ticked all the boxes in Starbucks, you can stuff it. It does absolutely nothing, but it does produce loads of paper to show to the non-execs and to show to the lawyers in your defense. Does this actually result in a change? No, it just passes the buck up until it gets ignored. Okay, 10 to 6, time for some conclusions. There's no doubt that governance has changed considerably, particularly in the last 5 years. I don't think anybody would want to go back to how it was 10 years ago. It has improved. There is much increased governance, and it has increased the workload on the finance functions considerably. 2 points about that: accept the inevitable. It is inevitable, it will get better, it will get worse, but actually it just requires the finance team to get better at delegating, better at organising, and it plays to finance strengths, so enjoy it. Secondly, my point would be that I worry that many CFOs and their teams are not equipped for the brave new world or the changed new world to take on these new responsibilities for governance, and they need to get some training pretty quickly. And a lot of that training is actually not about the technical aspects, it's about the interpersonal skills of how do you have the hard conversations that haven't been had in the past. As people have pointed out, it's all very well to have data on file that showed where the problem was, but nobody did anything with the data. The NEDs are definitely expecting the CFO to be an important function in the corporate governance structure in terms of challenging the rest of the organisation. And to do that without being some pariah within the organisation where everybody charges down the corridor in the opposite direction when they see the CFO walking this way, it is going to be very important because you need their trust, otherwise you'll never get the information out of them, but you also need to know how to do it in a good way. And second and finally, I think the CFOs have got to find a clever way of staying at the right hand
of the chief executive whilst doing those increased controls. The good news for the CFOs is that whilst the CEOs get fired quite quickly, the CFOs tend to last a lot longer. This is very good for us, and particularly for our pension schemes. So, three areas. I just think we need to recognise those things and move on. So, thank you very much. Thank you for listening. I hope I haven't kept you from your drinks today. Would anybody like to ask me some questions that they'd like to ask in public? Or alternatively, we can go upstairs, have a drink, and you can sidle up to me and ask the questions, a bit like my non-execs that you were too embarrassed to ask downstairs.
The basis of remuneration of independent directors. What is the basis of remuneration of independent directors?
Well, it's I can actually almost tell you pretty exactly what the scale is. It works out at £2,000 a day. But anything that the headhunters tell you is about the days you turn up at the organisation. And the best rule of thumb is double your workload to how many days you spend at the organisation. I basically work, if they say 24 days, I know it's a 48-day-a-year activity. There is a debate as to whether the non-execs should be incentivised. I would say absolutely not. We know what happens with incentivisation. I have seen with sales forces, I've worked in HSBC, I've seen what happens when you incentivise people. And it's amazing for how little amount of money people's ethics get moved, and what people will do. So the fact is that they are paid a finite amount of money for a finite job. If you actually ask them, and if this was a collection, and I've done various breakfast meetings of non-execs with the big accountancy firms, we all sit around and say, why on earth are we doing it for £2,000 a day? I'm putting my house at risk, I'm putting all my assets at risk, and if I get it wrong, the FSA are going to be coming after me. We don't do it. And I've rarely found anybody who did it for the money. We do it because it's interesting. A lot of people have ceased to work full-time, but like the challenge, and actually feel that they've got some skills to bring to the party. The problem tends to be I don't think there are enough good people there to bring those skills. But you know, that's the going rate for the job. 3 years, and you can be reappointed once, so you get 6. I would say that typically for the first year, you're learning. You're sitting there and you're watching. You really only become effective in the second year. But since you've only got, typically you might have four or five non-execs on the board, you've probably got one wearing the short trousers, and the other three are up to speed.
Philip, if I understand correctly, the skills that are lacking of a CFO currently are as follows, I believe. Understanding the entirety of the business, how the business works from the top to the bottom. The ability to manage and understand the functions of a board. The ability to manage and manipulate risk management. And I think there's one other area that I've missed out on here, interpersonal skills, the ability to hold your own, to able to say no and to carry out a battle if required to do so. Am I right?
I'm not saying they're missing. I'm saying they're very key features that people who are wanting to make the transition up from divisional CFO to the top CFO have to work on very considerably. Because often a lot of those they won't have needed at the lower level. And the distinction between a really good CFO and a poor CFO is often a failure
in a number of those areas. Yeah.
One more, I think.
In your experience, what would you say is the dividing line between the CFO and the CEO when it comes to formulating and articulating the strategy? Is there a time when you step back and allow the CEO to go his own way? Is it possible to work like that, or do you have to really agree on these sort of fundamental high-level decisions?
I think the concept that the CEO comes down from the mountain with his tablets of stone only exists in French companies. I've worked with, I've been the CFO for a président directeur général in an Anglo-French merger, and only in that organisation is there such a dictatorship. A strategy to be successful needs to be owned by the whole executive team and needs to be built up by the executive team. But there's no doubt that CEOs like to put their stamp on it and have a major, major contribution to it. But it's got to be worked up from a financial point of view by the CFO. It's got to be owned, tires kicked, by all the rest of the executives. And it's got to be effectively the considered view of that management team. But an interesting point I was talking about to some people at lunchtime is, I think a fault possibly of even, well, certainly American corporations and UK corporations is almost the excessive deference by the rest of the executives to the CEO. And having, you know, I've been party of an executive team where we thought the board was going well, we all hated and thought that the CEO was an idiot. It actually took a conversation in the pub when we were all suddenly admitted to each other that we were all looking for a job because we couldn't stand John, that ended up with the palace coup. and another example I'll give is, I was warned about this myself, and when I became a CEO, I suddenly discovered it can be a very lonely place because you daren't have a general chat with anybody and be indiscreet, because it'll be all over the organisation instantaneously. And the example I gave Rick at lunchtime was, I got into the lift as CEO, and there was a couple of lads in there, and they were all clearly going to a meeting, so I said, you know, well, what are you doing? Where are you going to a meeting? Oh, well, Phil's failed to get the book the room, so we're looking around for another meeting room. And I said, well, clearly Phil's a pillock, isn't he? A throwaway comment that I would have made jocularly. Unfortunately, within the rest of the organisation, Phil became known as Phil the Pillock. And it got so bad, they had to move him to a different job in a different place, in a different part of HSBC. Because I just throw that out as an example, but it is a situation that UK organisations, we can criticise French organisations for the cult of the PDG, but certainly American organisations and British organisations, there is a big cult of the CEO. And a lot of the problems, I think, can often be that the other executive directors fail to challenge the CEO as much as the NEDs fail to challenge the CEO. And that all applies in strategy, to come back and complete the loop for your question. Can I suggest that it's exactly 6 o'clock? I'm feeling thirsty. I'm sure you are.
Join me in thanking folks.